Everyone, welcome back to the show. I'm very excited to be here talking about what I think at this point I can say is unequivocally my favorite show that's still on the air and hopefully been on the air. Season 6 hasn't been announced yet, but I assume that's just a formality at this point. It's the one and only BoJack Horseman, and I say I'm very excited. I'm sure over the course of this episode we will go through a rollercoaster of emotions. And excited to be talking about with my two guests today. So Mike Bloom, who was on here last time we discussed BoJack, the first four seasons, going over all of that. And also Sadie Holloway, who you may remember from our Killing Eve episode a few months ago. I need to know at the top here, are you both having an awesome day?
Yes, though I'm a bit wary because I feel like Sadie might be the ghost of my former partner, Liana Boris. Or is that partner me? Or does the partner represent society? It's all so convoluted.
It's a metaphor. Everything is a metaphor, as we learned last season.
Yes, I am replacing Liana, who I also love. And it would have been fun if all three of us could have been here today, but I'll do my best. I remember she had a lot of great insights when she was on the last podcast, so hopefully I can bring something interesting to the table.
Well, I think one of the things about BoJack is that it evokes these very personal responses in each of its viewers. It's not the kind of show which you can just sit back and watch and not really feel anything about. So everybody is going to have not just their own story of how they came to the show, but also what the show means to them. But let's start with that first point, because I know, Mike, we spoke about your origin story with the show and mine, which was you recommending it to me and me being very slow on the uptake. But I'm a full convert now. What kind of expectations did you have coming into this season, coming out of season four, which took the show in a little bit of a new direction and one which most fans were still very happy with, but it raised some questions over where the show would go from here?
First, I'm happy to say that I made you a full convert. You are in the Abbey, much like the nuns that found poor character actress Margot Martindale on the beach 3/4 of the way through the season. Yeah, I mean, it left things in a really interesting place because it felt like for the first time in time, possibly ever in the history of BoJack Horseman, we ended a season on a genuine moment of light and hope that BoJack had finally, after being embroiled in family disarray for essentially his entire life, finally found a person in his family who wanted to be with him, who he loved, who he connected with without any sort of issue. And I had remained hopelessly optimistic as to that status sort of maintaining, which it did not. And it ties into sort of season five on the large. I'm still, even a couple weeks after finishing it up, of a couple of minds about it. But it's so interesting because you could frame it in a couple different ways where part of it feels like it's one step back, right? We see that, okay, when we start out, BoJack's, you know, he's on the show now. He's back on television in this serial role, serious role. He's even limiting his alcohol consumption. But for lack of a better phrase, he relapses. He allows his past demons to bubble up to the surface and involves him making some pretty damn scary choices over the course of the season. And I can understand some fans' frustration as to, you know, we thought we saw evolution in a person, and essentially he took one step back on the evolutionary scale. So I'll admit, I was a little disappointed with that because it felt like, okay, are the writers treading water? Do they know what the end goal is? Which we can definitely talk about. But on the other hand, in looking back on the season in preparation for this podcast, I do realize that there were a lot of things that moved the evolution of each of these characters forward. Even if the overall season didn't necessarily feel like a big step forward, I feel like individually, you know, the sum of the parts might be greater than the whole here.
Yeah, so Sadie, as far as I know, you were an earlier convert than I was. How did you come to the show, and what was your reaction to the first four seasons coming in, and how did that frame what your hopes and expectations were for this season?
So, yeah, I watched the show from the very beginning. I had a friend who was watching it and was complaining that they weren't really getting into it. So I just remember we were sort of sitting around kind of like having attention to an episode or two. And slowly my attention was just getting pulled more and more into the show. And by like the time I left to go home, I was like, I'd been paying attention to like two or three episodes straight, which is a lot for me. It did take a while for me to get into it, though. The first season, by like the end of the first season, I definitely was. It is weird at first. Like very, like it is this sort of inside baseball Hollywood story, which I don't always love. And then it's this kind of funny animation, but it just sort of grew on me. And so, yeah, personally, I loved the end of last season. I was incredibly satisfied with it and just sort of like at peace. And I was kind of okay with that being the end of the show, which I think is sort of not the kind of opinion a lot of people have. People wanted more because it's a great show. And I think so too, but I'm sort of like chasing contentment. So I was happy with the end of the show. I was happy, like when I was happy at the end of the season, I was like happy with that being the end of the show. Because I felt like at peace with where BoJack was, which is how I relate to, I guess, characters. Especially in a show like this, where it's not like it's not like a procedural. It's more character driven. So I just wanted it to end in a nice way, I guess. But yes, when it came back this season, like Mike said, I actually kind of not liked the backslide, but I understood why it was there, because that is real life and that is addiction. And I felt like it was almost unavoidable in a sense. The thing I wasn't expecting, because even though I liked the show for so long, I don't really keep up with like anything before it came out. Like I didn't know what was coming. So I was really surprised by how even more inside baseball it got with the Hollywood stuff and how sort of ripped from the headlines and very specific it was with the Me Too, Time's Up, Harvey Weinstein, Mel Gibson sort of parallels they were pulling in. So that really surprised me, but I actually really liked how it turned out. And I wasn't, when it first started, I wasn't sure, but I ended up liking it at the end. Or I ended up thinking it was really well done as it could have been.
Yeah, so listening to that, something that occurred to me, which I hadn't really had cause to think about in the past, was that in every prior season of BoJack, the finale could almost always be satisfying as the series finale in its own right. And I wonder if that's because the basic recurring story of the show is the same, where BoJack escalates his own behavior, addiction, and so on over the course of the season. There's some dramatic payoff for that in the penultimate episode, in the final act. And then just as the season closes, we see hope for a better future, potentially. And we know that next season we're going to come back again, and BoJack will slide into new pits of despair, and we'll have to go through this whole process. And I know that's the cause of frustration among some fans in a big picture sense as the show continues, that it feels like we're just kind of going through the same thing over and over again. But equally, as you said, that is a more realistic picture of self-improvement, right? And of life in general. It's, you take two steps forward, but there's also taking one step back, sometimes three steps back. It's not a linear process. And I think the show does embody that well, even if in a narrative storytelling sense, it can sometimes be a bit repetitive.
What this season actually proved to me is that I think at this point, Diane might be an equally important character as BoJack, even though she does not have, you know, her name over the title. It's like BoJack said with Gina, you know, like we're not really co-stars in Filbert because I'm Filbert. But essentially, this season in particular really hammered home for me like the twin phoenixes that are BoJack and Diane. I feel like this season in particular really honed in on their relationship. I feel like it's been a while, like not since season one when we had the two of them really working together on his biography, have we had them work so intimately together in so many different ways, you know, between her educating him about feminism and bringing him on board, to him hiring, getting her hired as a writer on Filbert, to, you know, her finding about this, about the boat with Charlotte, and then tying into, you know, the submarine, and then having their big brouhaha at the premiere, and then finally ending with her dropping him off at rehab. It just sort of made me realize that those were two characters that I didn't realize for a while we were sort of lacking their interactions with each other. They were, you know, they were importantly on their separate paths, and I'm sure we'll talk about that, especially in the beginning of the season. But it just really hit home for me in that final scene where he gets sent to rehab about how the two of them are so similar to each other, and I really do feel like that is the main relationship of the show. And so to your point, Dom, you know, if we can't necessarily rely on BoJack to constantly keep bettering himself, maybe we want to sort of attach our lodestar to a character like Diane, who has become increasingly interesting in my perspective of someone who was really trying to find her identity and find herself.
Yeah, I think Diane, despite being a flawed character in her own right, like everybody on the show is to some extent, is increasingly becoming the moral voice of the show. And it would be too easy if she was a perfect moral voice or if there was nothing critical about what she was saying. But when you stack up her misdeeds in the grand scope of things alongside Bojack's or really any other of the main characters other than maybe Todd, who can rise above the fray a little bit, then she does seem like she's the one person people maybe might listen to and should listen to.
I agree. And I feel like obviously they've always been there, but I think this season we sort of saw her flaws as they related to Bojack. And also when I say flaws, she's obviously morally pretty clean compared to like Bojack himself, but her flaws as they relate to him seem to be, she is really codependent and she's obviously trying to better herself in that regard. But also we see instances of part of why she's concerned about his behavior, which I'm sure we'll get into, is she's worried about how it'll look when people take a look at her because they're friends. And so there is a little bit of that sort of self-interest. And I'm glad that the writers weren't afraid to put that in, because I think that's a really real part of sort of how you feel about your own public perception. And no one, even people who are trying to be moral and do the right thing, there's always a little bit of, not always, but there's often just this self-interest in, I'm afraid of how it's going to look. And even people will argue that that's why people are good in general, is because they're afraid of what other people say. And so it was interesting to see Diane sort of say that to Bojack, and even initially when they were having the conversation. And that's sort of what people have been trying to get at when, like, these sort of stories come out about comedians and everyone's talking about it and criticizing. And then when it's someone like, I think Stephen Colbert, when he was talking about Les Moonves, he was saying like, what are you going to do when it's your guy? And like, how are you going to act when it's your guy? And that sort of came up in this show too. And then it's another thing I think they addressed really well with her.
When we have in episode 10, we finally have that big blow-up confrontation between Bojack and Diane. And that was a really interesting and necessary layer to it, I think. Diane had the self-awareness to admit that, yeah, part of this is concern for my own image, and whether you want to say that that's selfish or understandable, given that no one wants to be tarred by association with someone who they're looking out for, trying to do the best for. The fact that Bojack, after he had listed all of these different motivations for being angry at him over what he did, the fact that he instantly seized on that and made that the topic of the conversation now showed how bad of an influence he can be on both Diane and other people, that he finds any excuse to kind of deflect things away from his own behavior.
Yeah, I mean, and there's some really meaty stuff in the finale. I feel like any sort of proclivities I had about this season sort of got erased or at least mitigated by the finale. I said, you know what, if they're doing all this stuff, they better at least end on a really good note. And I feel like they did, specifically with Bojack and Diane. But Diane has this really great conversation with her boss, Stephanie, who up to this point, very typical, like, millennial, running a company, only focused on the clicks, very lady, etc. But, you know, Stephanie sort of calls her out on her bullshit and says, you know, you hold yourself to an impossible standard. You know, you are, it's creating really some toxicity in your personal life. And she says, well, shouldn't we be asking more of ourselves and the people in our lives? And Stephanie simply replies, of course, but we all fail, Diane. The world is unforgiving enough as it is. The least we could do is find ways to forgive each other and ourselves. And so going to the point that you made, Sadie, this whole final episode is really focused on Bojack trying not to be a Vance Wagner and really trying to own his own personal demons to the point where he goes to Diane and says, look, you need to publish, like, you need to go after me, like, tear me apart in your articles. But Diane sort of has this come to Jesus moment where she realizes that, like, when it comes to the world of media, you can write all the think pieces you want, you can push people away from all the projects that you want to, but at the end of the day, the only thing that's going to matter is if the person themselves hold themselves accountable for their action. If they don't, they become like Vance Wagner, who ends up coming back into another project and everything sort of gets smoothed over and it moves on. Louis C.K. does a show to standing ovations. Matt Lauer might be coming back to TV. What matters is if the individual themselves are holding themselves accountable for their actions. And Bojack shows that. He takes a step out of the path that other celebrities might have guided themselves towards by checking himself into rehab.
She did realize it. And this is kind of it's not a controversial line to take, but I guess it's one that people might disagree with, which is when she tells him, you're never going to be good because you're not bad. there's no good people or bad people. That's sort of something that comes up, and that's kind of something that I guess people argue about. It's something I definitely agree with. Definitely, and I'm sure there is a line, but there really are just people, I think, and then people who do good things and bad things. And I guess at the end of the day, what have you done? Like, what's in your ledger on the positive side and the negative side? They took the right stand and not saying, like, all these people are monsters. And I think now there's really, like, the tendency that we all want to be on the right side of history, and people just want to say, that's it, it's done, these people did bad things, and they're bad. And I think it was good of the show to address it this way. And they sort of touched on that too, with like you said, he's never going to be held accountable by society, because society doesn't know, like, society is too many people. They're never going to, or society or the media or whoever, they're never going to come to, like, a consensus that, like, this person's going to be held accountable for good, or this person should be given. So it's up to the person. And then this is something that Raphael Bob talked about in one of his interviews, which is, like, it's different. Like, how Diane views BoJack after this is different than how the audience should view him, and different than how, like, in the fictional world, the people of BoJack Horseman should view him, like his fans. Because the people you're closest to, their forgiveness is different than this sort of nebulous idea of being excused by society.
Mm. Yeah, I think what you're saying, Sadie, people tend to be reluctant to jump on board with that, because there's this idea that, well, that's just excusing their behavior if you're reluctant to label them as a bad person. But I kind of feel like it goes the other way, where if you make it about saying this person is bad or this person is good, you're making the debate about where that threshold is and what qualifies you as a good or a bad person, instead of just looking at, as you say, the total sum of their actions. And it's tempting to do that in a way, because then you can say, well, this is a bad person and I'm not like, so I must be a good person, as opposed to just being a person who starts with the same hand but has to play it in a morally upright way.
Yeah, and I think that it also sort of comes really interestingly from a self-introspective side of things, because BoJack has, from basically the get-go, from the very first penultimate episode, which he ends with asking Diane point blank, do you think I'm a good person? This is something that he's always sort of had formulating in his head, you know, I want to be a good person. And he believes by the end of this episode 11 that he is a bad person. That's why he wants Diane to take him down, because he is a quote-unquote bad person. He can never do any good. He destroys everything that's around him. So please give him the penance that he deserves. But what Diane gives him, as you guys were talking about, is sort of the truth as to, you know, it's almost uplifting in a way from that perspective, because BoJack, who's been beating himself up, understandably so, for being a quote unquote bad person, now has this revelation of, like, you are not doomed to the fate of being bad. You can make decisions to better yourself. And again, that just feeds really nicely into the choice to step foot into the rehab facility. It's emblematic of him essentially saying, like, I may think I'm a bad person, but I can do a good thing right now, which I think speaks miles ahead of, you know, the way BoJack, we saw into his head in a stupid piece of shit back in season 4. This is one step of him sort of starting to tune out those voices and bring in this new perspective.
And to touch on something that you said, Mike, that conversation that Diane has with Stefani, who I will say is one of my favorite characters in the show, not just because what she says is often hilarious, but with the main characters, you have to put the work in to make them complex and layered and to show those relationships evolving over time. But that gives you leeway with some of the secondary characters to make them into these fantastic caricatures. And she lampoons the archetype that she's meant to lampoon so perfectly that I love the way she does that. And I love that they have the creative freedom to both dive deep into the main cast and then also flesh out supporting cast with these figures who maybe only pop up once or twice an episode, if that, but when they do, you always value their presence there.
I think part of why BoJack wants to be, I guess it's more just a character thing with him, but part of why he wants to be sort of publicly flagellated, and why he's society and the people, like his audience, his fans, the people who like watch him, and the reason he's famous, basically, the reason he wants their sort of punishment is because he does believe he's a bad person. And the way he gets sort of not even his validation in this case, but sort of that's how he exists. And that's how he sees himself, is how society sees him. And that's sort of, you could say, how celebrities are. They want the validation, or they want the, they don't know who they are, or they don't see themselves unless it's being reflected by how the audience sees them. That's obviously not true of anyone, in any one group of people, including actors, but it's definitely true of him. He wants the validation. He wants the attention. He wants to be seen as a good actor, and he'll pick out when someone says something good about him, he'll find the negative, but
yeah, I think BoJack's realization that leads him to make that request of Diane, it's partially grounded in, I think, just the depression that BoJack has exhibited this entire time, which is, even if he weren't a bad person, he would think that he was, and he would think that everyone did hate him and was justified in hating him. But also, maybe, finally, at long last, a realization that, actually, they're right. I am a bad person, or at least I have been doing bad things, and maybe some kind of public accountability is necessary if I and them are going to be able to move past that. I think there are a lot of ways that we could tackle this, whether it's just going through individual episodes, individual characters, or touching on some of the larger themes of the season. So, Mike, I know that you mentioned that it seemed like coming into season 5, things were looking up, at least on the family front with Jack. He has Hollyhock there. He's finally got someone in his life who he needs to be a role model to, which I think was a crucial thing for him. It's not enough to just, like, not get mad at Todd sometimes and hope that Todd will improve his lot in life. He actually needs someone who cares about him, and he has a reason to care about that, to ground him ethically and to keep him on the straight and narrow. And it looks like Hollyhock is going to be that person, and we see in the first episode he's still getting adjusted to that, and it's going to take him some more time, but it feels like that's the one thing that he can keep going back to kind of rein him in at his worst. And yet after this episode, Hollyhock just disappears and doesn't resurface again until she plays this role in the storyline with BoJack's drug addiction in episode 9. In some ways, I would have liked to see her intermittently throughout the season, just to check in and to set that up in advance. But it does almost feel fitting that this one positive influence that BoJack thinks he has just disappears and then only comes back in the course of something that's even more negative.
I agree. And I totally agree that, like, I'd love to see more Hollyhock. I really liked Aparna Nancherla's work in the fourth season. So I was a little sad to see her only in a couple of episodes. But if it ties into this larger theme in retrospect of the blurred line between fiction and reality. To the point where we open on this episode, we see Filbert, the set, it looks exactly like BoJack's house or David Boreanaz's house. And we start to see, you know, he's starting to push back a bit with Flip on this character because, you know, he vocalizes, you know, he's a drunk, he's an asshole, I don't want to be him. And even though Princess Carolyn tries to urge him, like, you'll just leave this here and then you'll sort of turn it off and you'll become BoJack. That is much easier said than done, even from an actor perspective. You know, you hear horror stories mostly about Jared Leto of people who take, you know, becoming characters way too far. And the interesting thing about episode 1 as well is that BoJack feels like everything is cosec right now. Like you said, he has Hollyhock. He excitedly calls her when he likes her Instagram posts. He's got the show going. He's casually sleeping with his co-star. You know, everything's going well. But Flip vocalizes this when he's talking about this nude scene that he writes in. Everyone's fine with it but you. And it almost seems like he's telling BoJack, everyone's fine but you. And it feels like while this might have been a bit of like a, I don't know, a bit of a tepid opener. It wasn't like a big bang boom like we're going to see with future episodes this season. It does a really good job of setting up BoJack's main sort of storyline this season, which is the fact that, you know, this character he's trying to, this part of himself that he's trying to keep separated on the screen is going to keep reaching out to the screen and drag him in so they eventually merge into one in this horrific penultimate episode.
Oh, I think they also do a good job of setting up his character, the way he progresses or regresses throughout the season, because even in this first episode, he obviously doesn't want to be old BoJack, but he's trying so hard to be new BoJack, and people see through it. Like, there's a sense of when he's protesting the nude scene and Flip sort of says, well, fine, he's protesting the nude scene with Gina, and Flip sort of says, I'm with you. And if you don't do it now, we know you weren't ever really concerned about the male gaze. You were just putting it on. And that sort of happens throughout the season where, and this is like a Twitter term, but this sort of fake wokeness that he brings when he pretends that he's upset about the male gaze for the nudity scene. And then he sort of wants to know how to appear as a feminist, And even like smaller things that aren't as serious, he wants to appear like someone who's cool and would do his own stunts, but he doesn't really want to do it. He's sort of always looking for a way to kind of backslide in these subtle ways where he doesn't fully commit to being this new good guy. They really acknowledge that part of him is putting it on. And there is that attitude of fake it till you make it. And also, if you're faking it and but you're still being good, does it really matter if it's not 100% sincere? Your behavior and your treatment of others is still the same. But they definitely, it comes up throughout the season that he's not, he wants to be better, but it's not 100% genuine change. He's really pushing himself to do it.
And that, I think, ties into one of the larger themes, not just of this season, but of the entire show as a whole, of you have to put the work in. You have to do things, not just perform or not just say the right things. And that's always been something that the show has had as its mission statement, but you see that be so much more explicit in this season. And that goes for basically all of the main characters and some of the secondary characters too. So it's going to be a theme time and time again with Bojack, but also with Diane and Princess Carolyn, and everybody's going to be dragged into this concept in some way. And if there are several main defining features of the season, I would say that's definitely one of them.
Yeah, for a second, I guess, since we're starting with, the first episode, I want to talk at large about Flip McVicker, because I do feel like every season we sort of get this, like person who, at least I was a little surprised that we get in a really recurring basis. Like, last season was Holly Hawk. We had Wanda, voiced by Lisa Kudrow, in season two. It seemed to be Flip this season, which makes sense, because season five, BoJack's big project, is Filbert. To be honest, I'm trying to figure out if I liked Flip. I love Rami Malek, and I understood what the show was doing and really trying to send up, especially in this golden age of TV. You have a lot of shows that, to your guys' point, sort of put on air sometimes about like being deep, but it's honestly just leaving things purposely vague and basically making the audience write the script themselves. I wouldn't say that he had too many big laugh, goofy moments, so maybe that was sort of what separated him from the rest of the characters, but I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out what I personally think about him as a character and as a device in this season.
Is it bad that I only really, really liked him when he was a dolphin? What does that say to me? But I thought that was the funniest part. Maybe it was just the absurdity of the whole episode, but I thought like they really hit what they were going for with this whole like phony auteur persona that they were trying to skewer. I think they really nailed it when he was a dolphin.
Yeah, it turns out the use of animals as a comedic device goes a long way in BoJack over time.
It really does.
But yeah, you
know, silent animals that only squeak.
Yes. But it's fascinating to me, Mike. You were unsure whether you liked Flip, because to me, he seemed like almost the caricature of, as Sadie said, like the wannabe genius showrunner, this creative genius who uses that as an excuse to be an asshole, and who it seems to believe that his assholishness is what makes him genius, and the two are inextricably linked, and there's no way he can have this creative output without treating people like garbage, and that if that was true, that would justify it, because his creative work is so good that it overwhelms everything else. When if you look at how he treats people over the course of the season, Flip is, he is one of the guys who this movement is coming from, not explicitly, even though he does harass BoJack, and that's just never mentioned again. But also, he's the type who, he's not going to be called out in public like it seems like BoJack is going to be, like several other figures have been, but he's no less abusive of the people that he's working with and working for.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess, you know, this show tried to make a statement as well with like him admitting that like things were a sham, you know, during, I think it was that aforementioned episode where he was a dolphin half the time, was like him having a meltdown about how he doesn't realize what he's doing, essentially. And there are fun skewering moments, like at the premiere when he would refer to this as like not the first episode, but the first chapter, because the TV show is more like a novel. And you have to assume that Raphael Bob Waksberg is also sort of poking fun at himself as well. This feels like maybe the most meta season of BoJack Horseman, specifically to talk about like the anti-hero stuff and Diane accidentally realizing that in game vulnerabilities to her main character, she actually made them like gave a rooting interest in them. It just feels like maybe Raphael felt like, this had become, things had gotten going enough that he can sort of poke fun at specifically what he's going for and the reception to the show in hand.
I know he doesn't like to call out specifically if he's making fun of anyone in particular. Like he said that Filbert isn't really a spoof on True Detective. It's sort of an amalgamation of shows. But I really feel like Flip was Ryan Murphy crossed with Quentin Tarantino. That's what I got from him.
Yeah, he would never stoop so low as to call out anyone by name, but you can tell who he's firing his shots at. And I agree, Mike, that this season is more meta. It's like almost more extreme than that. That doesn't do it justice. Like, this season is meta about being meta as well. Like, it's trying to take ownership of all of that, and that itself is a major plot point now, and not just something that... it's not like a throwaway thing that the more astute viewers can pick up on. Like, that is something that, as a fan, you can't help but confront when you watch a show.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, probably, I don't know, again, if I might be projecting, but I feel like when Diane says something like, you know, if Filbert is just a way for dumb assholes to rationalize their own behavior, then I'm sorry we can't put this out there, they might be talking about another adult animated show that has really garnered a lot of fervor and philosophical thinkings due in part to the nihilistic philosophies of its main character. Again, I don't know if he would outright say it, but it definitely did garner a lot of comparisons next to my cups of Szechuan sauce that I've hoarded for the past 2 years.
Yeah, so this first episode, we mentioned that Hollyhock is someone that we wanted to see more over the course of the season. And part of that for me is I think that would have been an interesting contrast or side-by-side with Princess Carolyn's ongoing struggle with fertility and trying to find someone that she can put into that role in her own life. Because BoJack was landed but with Hollyhock and at first seemed to resent the fact that she was even in his life. But that's something that Princess Carolyn has desperately wanted for decades now and is continually trying to find. And it looks like by the end of the season, she's get there. But when we meet her in episode one, she's going through this adoption agency or adoption manager, if you prefer. And it looks like this
sounds
is
a great joke.
She's trying to realize this, but you know how BoJack works. You have the sinking feeling that this is going to end in disappointment for Princess Carolyn somehow.
Yeah, well, I mean, we'll definitely get to it with her standalone episode, but I really do feel like her mom, just fantastically, fantastic casting across BoJack Horseman in general. But I feel like the choice to cast David Sedaris to play Amy Sedaris's character's mother is just completely inspired. But this whole talk about the roulette wheel of life and winners and losers, you can say about, you know, the old lost adage of make your own luck. But Princess Carolyn is dealing with some pretty shitty luck the past 4 seasons. And a lot of it is some of it is self-inflicted. You know, you give like Ralph as an example, who comes back into the picture for part of this season. But, you know, she's the one who could have taken him back. And so you can sort of put it on her. But yeah, her storyline this season, I felt awful about her character after the events of season 4. So I was hoping beyond hope out of all the characters that she would do well, just because I do sympathize her with, you know, being a workaholic while also trying to, you know, manage relationships and family at the same time. But I just sort of, I don't know, I guess I had sort of been ground down, much like her mother, that like she was not going to get the happy ending no matter how much she deserved it. So when it actually did sort of come a little light at the end of the tunnel at the end, I was happy about it.
I think Princess Carolyn did get, like, if it's about luck, I think she got unlucky and she got the losing lottery ball. But she's been, like, relentless in making it, like, in turning it around. Because, like you said, she always gets unlucky, but I feel like she, even though some of it's, like, supposed to be meant to be, like, a little, like, seem a little underhanded when she's, like, fixing all these problems and dealing with everyone over the phone and she and Diane how to manipulate Flip. But she's really, like, trying to get people to be successful. Like, she's trying to have a positive influence on their careers. She did it with Cooper. She's like, if you want something, you have to ask for it. And so she sort of has her mother's philosophy, if it's true, that you either get a winning ball or a losing ball. If she got the losing ball, she sort of really represents the character who's trying to change their lot in life and really does work towards it despite everything. And obviously she's imperfect, like all the characters. But I really liked her this season, almost the most I've ever liked her. And I've always liked her.
Yeah, she touches on something which is fairly unique in the BoJack universe, of that tension between being this workaholic, having this clear career focus in your life you want to continually improve and work towards, and that's a measure of your own value and success, versus this just this parental instinct that she's completely unable to find a vessel for, I guess. And there's this question that at some point she and the show will have to confront of whether her becoming a parent would be what she wants, whether it would meet all of these expectations that she has set for her and whether that would actually make her happy. And we have this general statement in the show time and time again that you can have everything that you think you want, but that still doesn't guarantee happiness. And I worry that what we're going to see maybe next season with her is she's going to find herself in that role, but maybe it's not what she expected. And the realities of having to care for an infant and being incredibly stressed while also working these long weeks at this stressful career and having to juggle all that is only going to leave her even more miserable in the short term.
Well, I guess the question is, you know, what will she come back to? Because, you know, she had given up the agency game to be a producer, and it pretty much seems like Filbert is, you know, down the toilet. Would she want to move on to something? I mean, should we look into her, the joke of her calling her new baby Untitled Princess Carolyn Project, that this is the thing that she's going to work on now? There could be something interesting in season six where, you know, she is, when we see her at the start, she's a complete full-time mom. But then we start to see sort of like the glimmers pop up of her wanting to be attracted to the showbiz life and her really trying to weigh one against the other, which is really, you know, her entire onus. Even the bereft adoption manager slash, you know, the one half of the twins who don't realize they're twins says in the finale, you know, do you want to live the life you clearly rather be living? And yeah, I mean, she touched on something that, as much as Princess Carolyn wants to say she can do it all, I imagine that she would put one above the other when push came to shove.
Yeah, and that's, I think, going to be a tough choice for her to make. And if you ask her in this moment, she might give you one answer, but then find herself making the other choice in practice. As you said, it is the just absurdly unempathetic and lazy adoption manager who has this moment of insight with her. And I think that's often a recurring theme about the show, and it's something that I was intending to get to when I mentioned Stefani earlier, that it's often these minor characters who exist mainly as the butt of the joke who sometimes say these things that are very on point and which the characters themselves, if they were listening, might want to take to heart.
Yeah, and it reminds me all the way back in the finale season two when you have the runner, literally, of the baboon running every time we cut to an exterior of BoJack's house, and he's the one who swoops in with, like, the very last line of season two, which is him saying, you know what, it gets a little easier, but you have to do it every day, which is something that, you know, in my own struggles with anxiety and depression is something that I have sort of had constantly running in my head, pun unintended. So yeah, you bring up a good point, Dom, that, like, in terms of fleshing out this world, they did a great job of bringing characters in and out, but they also have this ability to just make these characters three-dimensional in a way that, like, even the most daft people can occasionally pop in and provide the most profound wisdom, which both comes from a nice comedic angle of, like, oh, here's the person we thought was a complete non-entity the entire time, and now they appear to give stage advice. And on the other hand, it's oddly enough more realistic in a show that features, you know, anthropomorphic animals.
What did you both make of the on-show, Sadie, as the choice of the prospective surrogate parent, if you like, for Princess Carolyn? Because the contrast between the two of them, I think, worked effectively, but it's interesting to explore what other things they could have done with that as well.
I think they went very traditional and very much, I think, that's the trope of the pregnant teenager. And her reaction to it, because they obviously, in that same episode, they show Princess Carolyn going through the same thing. And her reaction to it, and this sort of, the silver lining that her mother is saying to her, which is like, well, now you can have a good life because of who the baby was conceived with. Like, that's a new family for you, and that's a good thing. And the character Sadie was sort of in a different thing, where, like, her life was kind of going to be the same if she kept the baby with her. But she seems sort of content with that. And I think the show did a pretty good job of not making it seem like that she was silly for being okay with it, with being understanding of her lot in life, sort of. Mm. I think they do a good job of not saying either way how they feel about people who are very ambitious with how they feel with people who are satisfied with things as they are. And I do think that maybe it's because that's exactly what I expected when they got there. I thought she had some really funny lines, but the character that she was looking at for the baby was exactly what I expected. So maybe you're right. Maybe there was more they could have done with her, but it was so much in line with what you sort of expect to see in these stories. I think the fact that they had a contrast with someone like Princess Carolyn but as two people who had been in similar situations, I thought that worked well enough.
Yeah, and first of all, again, fantastic casting. Like Jamie Presley, she brought this like really fun energy to it. To Sadie's point about how she'll throw in these like random innuendos and then follow them up with explaining the joke, which she was able to pull off. A kid usually explaining the joke is not usually a funny thing, but I mean, it all comes to this. Like, I wouldn't say fantastic, but it comes to this really interesting point near the end where Princess Carolyn was in helping her hawk her wares. She teaches her, you know, you can sell people anything if you just sell people the idea they're not being sold to. And essentially, that's what Princess Carolyn has been doing the entire episode to Sadie. That like, ooh, I love these jalapenos. Yep, I remember being in North Carolina, really enjoying myself. And we find out via these flashbacks that like, she could not wait to get out of there. As she says, you know what from means? It means you don't have to be there anymore. She, much like Amelia Earhart, took off, didn't want to see North Carolina again. And it's so interesting that, to your point, you might have seen her at the stop, like stereotypical teen mom, like a little hickish, doesn't necessarily sort of falling for the whims of Princess Carolyn. So I love the fact that it gets turned around at the end, that she says, listen, I've been seeing all the stuff that you're doing. You can't fool me. It shows that Princess Carolyn, I mean, this is what Sadie calls her out on. I think she sort of thinks she's better than her. That she says, like, give the baby, I can provide her a good life. And she says, what you're essentially inferring is that I can't provide this child a good life. And so I'm happy that it's, again, it's sad to watch Princess Carolyn sort of get beaten down and take two steps back when she took one step forward initially. But I think it's deserved considering the way that, you know, Princess Carolyn, I treat this like another agency, movie transaction when it wasn't. There are human players involved. And as a result, things get a bit messier than that.
And it sets up this unconventional power dynamic as well, when by every normal standard, Princess Carolyn is in a much happier and much more successful life than Sadie is. And she's living in LA, she's doing well in her career, she's living the high life. In a lot of ways, dreamed of as a teenager, growing up in Eden in that same location, whereas Sadie is stuck there. She hasn't got from Eden yet, she's still stuck in that place. And yet Sadie has this thing to offer Princess Carolyn that means the world to her, means more than any of the other stuff, any of her worldly successes have done. And so we see the lack of that be this real void inside Princess Carolyn that she's trying to fill. And you feel some sympathy for her while also recognizing that, as you said, Mike, she has to effectively manipulate Sadie or manipulate whoever the prospective adoptive parent is into giving her what she wants. It's like the highest stakes sales job that she's ever going to have to put on someone. And so you're kind of wrestling with how you feel about that internally. And then likewise with Sadie, she is living a miserable life in a lot of ways. And she has people, she's surrounded by people who don't have her best interests at heart, or at least don't know how to satisfy those or convey that. And yet she knows that in that one moment, this one person coming into her life as this intruder, as this alien, she has this power over them in a weird way, and she's not accustomed to dealing with that.
And I guess we're staying on the Princess Carolyn note. Any thoughts about the momentary appearance from Ralph, about how it starts out, Princess Carolyn having to call Ralph because Mr. Peanut Butter wants to option a greeting card for a movie? But it steers in a very atypical direction when, they're having dinner. It seems like things are okay. Like, you even get, like, their old relationship flickering back when, like, her phone rings. And he's like, all right, I know you have to answer that. Like, it makes you realize just how, in my opinion, how adept they were for each other. And then he accompanies her to this hospital. There's a baby being born right the second, which I don't think that's things go. But this is also quasi-reality that BoJack Horseman, BoJack Horseman exists in. And while they're there, Ralph sort of tries to talk her into, raising the child together. We see some crackling under the surface. Well, says like, remember when I offered adoption as an option and you decided not to take it during that heartbreaking episode last season? And Ralph essentially offers to, help raise the child with her. But Princess Carolyn goes into this speech, which ends up losing her the day, but how, she has fostered herself as a single mother, and as a result he is once again spurned. He'll wait for her to take up the taxi, but otherwise I personally don't know if we're gonna see him again, which stinks because I feel like he's really good for her. But again, in a world full of infinitely complicated characters like BoJack Horseman, they don't always make the right decisions, and you could see where Princess Carolyn's coming from here.
I think they're just point blank saying that she is kind of complicated in a way that makes this relationship and makes what she wants really hard to pin down, because I didn't even know what they were trying to get at when she's like, when they're talking, I think this is still when they're at dinner, and she's like, I wish you hadn't left me that day. And he's like, well, you asked me to leave. And she's like, well, I wish you would have known that I wanted you to stay. I think after that, I think that he was sort of well within reading the conversation to be like, do you want me here with you? Like, we can raise this baby together. Like, if I made this mistake last time and not understanding what you really wanted, was it what you were comfortable saying out loud? Like, if I made that mistake last time, I won't make it again. And she's still pushing back. So it was weird. She basically said, like, I didn't mean it last time, or I wanted you to stay. But then even when he sort of says, okay, like, we got that out of the way. You want me here? And she's still on it. I think that was really interesting and does sort of tie into this idea of, like, yes, she wants this baby and she wants to be a mom and sort of fulfill that thing that she's feeling missing inside of her. But at the same time, is she going to be so enjoy it for all it's worth, or can't really commit to it for all it's worth? Because I liked that moment. I felt this great sense of satisfaction at the last episode when the show gets canceled, Filbert, and she's like, it's all over. And you think she's going to be sad, but she's relieved and she's gone. Like, they cut back to her and she's gone. She's gone to see the baby. I think that was a great moment, but at the same time, is she so unsure of what she wants that it's not, like with anything in the show, it's not really going to last, is it?
And I think it touches on yet another one of these suggestions that the show makes, that someone can be a smart choice for you, but not the right choice. And I think that might be the place that Ralph occupies in Princess Caroline's life, when we see her push him out of her life last season. And you know, based on what we see of Ralph, that he likely would be a good father figure, or a good person to have around, at the very least, to help with this incredibly difficult new project of raising the baby. And yet that doesn't mean that necessarily they have that intrinsic compatibility that would make them a good unit together.
And then also, there's a really interesting point of her sort of giving up on Filbert, because let's remember, probably the only reason why she signed up to do Filbert in the first place is because she met Flip by happenstance at the end of last season and saw a script with the name Filbert on it, which was the name of the child that she wanted to have with Ralph. And she saw it again as a sign. She saw maybe the roulette wheel was spinning one more time, and maybe it's a sign from above that she'll end up a winner. And so in a manner of speaking, she was sort of giving up one child to embrace another.
One of the things you notice watching the season is the fragmentation among the main cast, that you have obviously a literal fragmentation between Diane and Mr. Peanut Butter, but also Todd is off doing his own thing as usual, and he never really gels with the group in any sense. Princess Caroline is focused on her own storyline, and then in terms of her career, she reaches out to others as it relates to that. But you do get the same interpersonal dynamics, or interspecies dynamics in some cases, that you had in the previous season. So what did you make of the ways that those relationships as a whole evolved over the season?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough because there's only so many amalgamations of the main five characters you can do, right? I mean, and they were able to sort of shoehorn Todd and Diane and Mr. Peanut Butter into Filbert by saying, oh, yeah, Mr. Peanut Butter ends up getting cast. Todd, through BoJack's, scheming, is able to get him in a position in corporate America because it's Todd. Diane gets brought in by BoJack, but you could sort of feel the strain sometimes in trying to bring all five characters together. And I'm happy that in previous seasons, the show didn't necessarily feel like they had to bring them back together. They'll occasionally sort of like cross in and out of each other's lives. But yeah, this season in particular, maybe it's because Princess Caroline was doing the most traveling out of everyone, but she felt, actually no, considering what Diane does, but it felt like her stuff was just so separate from everyone else that I don't know if I was necessarily mad at it. Like, after the fantastic episode she had with BoJack in season 3 in the restaurant, like, I'm okay not needing to revisit that well time and time again. You know, I'm happy at least from that perspective that the show knows that, like, when a certain thing happens, I'm going to put a pin in that and not necessarily erase it and rebuild the relationship. That's always sort of going to be there. So we have this sort of end to the relationship between BoJack and Princess Caroline, where they do interact with each other, but it's not the same as it was before. So I guess I could understand it, even though I do miss Amy Sedaris and her not as many tongue twisters from Amy Sedaris this season, which was surprising.
I personally, I don't mind the characters being split up. I think that the moments where they are together, when it's a significant relationship, make up for it. Like BoJack and Diane were apart for a lot of the season, and those moments of them, like, just sort of brushing the edges of their conflict, but then sort of pushing it back under the rug, only to escalate in the very end of the season. That was all worth it for me. And yeah, like Todd and BoJack hardly interacted at all. Same with, even though Princess Carolyn worked on the show, she actually felt like pretty separate. Like their storylines felt pretty separate from each other. And Dom might have mentioned at the beginning of the show that was interesting, considering he sort of got last season what she's trying to get now in this idea of family. But I did like her storyline, and I just wanted to touch on something going back to that episode, the Amelia Earhart episode, which is they touch a lot about like parent-child sort of generational storytelling and how things are passed along and how you sort of learn based on the environment you grew up in. And I just, on a personal level, I suppose, I really liked what they did with her mother. And it wasn't like, it wasn't as like specific, I feel like, as if they try to do with BoJack and his parents. And it was a little more vague, or broad, I guess the word would be, but there's something about that moment in the airport where she's about to go off to school and her mom's like, I need you here. Maybe you should just defer and stay another year. Can't you do this one thing for me? That's probably the one of the, like, I feel like I've had that moment in my life. It felt so real. And it was so disappointing and sad to me that I'm glad it was in there, because that's sort of what you look for in this show, is like a moment that you can really relate to. And that was just such a moment of like feeling like her in that moment must have felt so burdened, and like she had to let her down, but she did it anyways. It was just a great moment, and I really liked that for her character.
Inference is that that's the last time she saw her, right? Like, I can't remember exactly what they were talking about in the beginning of the episode, but she said that she basically hadn't been back to Eden since her mom's funeral, and then before that it had been a long time.
Yeah, and in a season which is so much about these people who either are parents and the effect that they have on their kids, or they want to be parents and they want to have hopefully better effects on their kids, you have on one very far end of the spectrum, you have BoJack's entire extended family, where anyone who's had any maternal or paternal influence over him or his parents is just an out-and-out terrible person. It's interesting to have Princess Carolyn there, who you can tell that is an unhealthy relationship, and that her mother has... her actions are holding her back, and that they are having this negative effect, but it's not as like this obvious caricature that the way that Butterscotch Horseman is, for instance, right? You can see that Princess Carolyn's mother does care for her on some level, but she's so bad at expressing that and so bad at wrapping her head around that what that means for Princess Carolyn, and that sometimes that means letting her make her own choices. And yeah, that final conversation when pleading with her to just stay one more year, it's that use of dependency as leverage is something which I think a lot of people that is the oh fuck, I this is my own autobiography moment for a lot of people.
Yeah, and it's totally, like you said, the opposite of Butterscotch Horseman telling young BoJack after soccer practice, you know, you're lucky because no one else is going to take care of you. She's asking literally for her daughter to take care of her.
Right, and it's the realization that in itself can also have profoundly negative effects, that we say deep in like a ironic sense, but it is actually profound, more so than just Butterscotch Horseman clearly is a terrible person, and if you don't recognize that, then there's no real progress to make there.
Yeah, I definitely think so, and I think they did a good job. Like I kind of hesitated to sort of say that BoJack's family was a caricature, but I guess they are sort of meant to be that way, and I'm sure it does reflect real experiences, obviously, but I do think that they did a job of bringing a different dynamic with Princess Carolyn's mother in particular.
Yeah. So as we take this tour around the main cast, I don't want to say we have to check in with Todd, but it does feel like that in some sense, where Todd, his content is so much at odds with everyone else's in the season, and sometimes that can be this refreshing palate cleanser, right? You need some levity in there to lighten the mood a little bit. But increasingly, as the show deals with these very knotty and difficult topics, to have Todd there, it can feel jarring at times. And even though his storyline itself was fleshed out in a more serious way, that contrast is there.
There's this weird sort of microcosm moment where, like, I realized there was one scene where it was just him and Diane, and you could tell, even as humans, I don't know what it was, but they look so different. Like, they're animated so differently. I guess maybe sort of a microcosm of how the two characters or how the writers are sort of approaching their material. Like, I am happy with Todd because I feel like we do. I mean, this is brought up in the Bobo the Angsty Zebra episode. Like, I think we need Todd's levity sometimes, especially when the show gets super heavy. And I'm glad that they've also given Todd some of his own more serious moments, like, you know, especially his discovery into his asexuality. And I loved that episode with Yolanda. And it was the perfect mix of stupid silly. You have Todd with this French farce where, of course, Yolanda's family, this asexual person has a family where, what, the dad is a porn director, the mom's a porn star, and the twin sister wants to have revenge sex with him because of something that happened in high school. And it leads to the door farce thing where this lube gets spilled and everyone's slip sliding all over the place. But then it sort of boils down to, like, this really interesting kind of serious moment where Todd realizes, like, the only asexual person he's made a connection with, he's only made a connection with them because they're asexual. And you sort of realize, like, oh yeah, asexuality has similar pitfalls as being in a sexual relationship as well. And I'm kind of sorry that we didn't go back to that. You know, go ahead.
Oh, no, sorry. I think they tried to kind of get back to it in a different way. I think Todd's really funny. I think he's sort of, his comic relief to me is, like, it's not like the shows aren't comparable one-to-one, but when sort of the Jason Mendoza character on The Good Place has sort of these non sequitur, wacky hijink ideas, they don't work for me as often as the Todd ones on this show do. And it's different. It's interesting because, like, The Good Place is a lot zanier overall, whereas this show sort of tries to blend everything together more, like serious and comedy. But I think Todd's sort of one-liners and his hijinks and sort of when he says something that makes no sense, honestly, I find it pretty funny most of the time. I do agree that his storylines in the past have been, like, totally out of place sometimes and just felt jarring. And I do think while the show has gotten more serious, I do agree that, like, it in moments, it's definitely a little out of place. Like, but I think the zany things, like Henry Fondler at the end of the season, it did sort of tie into the overall theme. And I did think the way they dealt with his asexuality this season, I think they touched on, like, some interesting things that people talk about in real life. And I think oftentimes they're related to, like, when you're gay in high school and you only know one other gay kid, like, yeah. is that just what, and I think that the fact that they're touching on it with asexuality instead of homosexuality is kind of bringing a new light to the issue. And I feel like at the end, again, I forget what episode, when Emily comes back and they're sort of talking about, this is who I really connect to, but, like, we're not compatible in that way. And they're sort of even trying to delve into, like, well, some asexual people have sex sometimes, and would that be something we could do? And he's sort of trying to prod in the opposite direction of, like, well, maybe we could still be together, but without the sex, and then you can have this robot for that. Like, I think they were trying to sort of touch on the fact that, like, when your pool of options are limited, you sort of are left with what you're left with and the sort of hardship that brings. But also, on the other end, the same idea of, like, what kind of compromises can be made in a relationship? And because there are relationships that do involve a lot of compromise in different areas. And I think maybe, I don't know if they would touch on it again next season, but I think for what they did with it, I thought it was pretty interesting. Like, it was very, maybe I didn't watch enough stuff, but I felt very, like, specific and unique to me.
And the asexuality storyline, I know that a lot of people said that it kind of out of left field last season, and it felt like it was just trying to, we need to give Todd something to do, so let's graft the storyline onto him, and that can be his recurring shtick, which I think for a lot of that criticism is they didn't relate to it personally, so it was always going to feel forced or out of place. But also, with this season, they've had more time to develop that, first of all, but then secondly, the way that it does actually tie into some of the more serious commentary that the show is trying to offer in what I think is a fairly thoughtful way, I think that works. I think they struck by balance there. And the episode that focuses on Todd and Yolanda, for a lot of people, they said the comedy of that didn't really land. They felt that was a bit too extreme and a bit too much of a catch-all. But to me, that read as a commentary on what just media in general and life in general is like for asexual people, who they are constantly surrounded by this hypersexual media, where, like, if you look at any show on TV, that the default position is that characters hooking up or characters getting together or that them having to discuss that is the default mode of character development. And if you can't think of anything else, if you can't move the story forward, introducing some kind of romantic subplot is the easiest way to get yourself out of that situation. And that can just be forced in there in lieu of any genuine exposition or any thoughtful plot development. That's just the easy way to handle that. And so it's almost a window into what life's like all the time for people in Todd's position. So you would hope that people would recognize that, but they don't seem to have done based on the commentary I've seen.
Yeah, and I to the point that I was saying before, I really like that stuff. I wanted to see more of it personally, because I totally agree that I think it's a really interesting well to sort of plumb it. It's not too dissimilar from, you know, the century, when people were sort of looking into stories about homosexuality. They didn't necessarily represent the gay agenda at large, but I think it sort of told stories that not a lot of people had firsthand experience with before. So I kind of wish we had more of that, because as you said, we do sort of bring back the Henry Fonda stuff, which was also cartoonish, but I loved how that sort of came to bear fruit at the end of it, when, of course, like, the biggest commentary on the Me Too Time's Up stuff is the literal sex robot, and how unintentional irony that, like, he gets brought down and fired because of sexual harassment, but of course in the process several other women get fired as well, proving that there's, like, no true justice that occurs in Hollywood. So I would say that I really like the asexual stuff this season, probably much more than, like, the Todd being in what time is it now.com, you know, corporate structure was fine. I think he was more serious about this job than he was any other job previous, which was really interesting. But if I had balanced the two, I would have loved to see more of the asexual stuff of that, though. Here's hoping that they're just trying to sort of prime some more interesting material for him come next season.
And I think he's also pointing out that it took a literal sex robot who is programmed to say those things to recognize that kind of behavior as a problem within the BoJack universe, and that it's a sign of how normalized it's become, to use a word that BoJack ruminates on, that someone like that can even get into that position in the first place, and it can just go unrecognized. The last time we did this, Mike, I was fairly critical of Todd as a character. It's like, he's entertaining, sure, but it's not what I tune into BoJack for. He is much more in tune with what I've come to expect from the show, and he feels like more of a part of a cohesive whole than he did in seasons past.
Well, let's talk about the other side of that coin then, because we did have, you know, it was nice to see him and Mr. Peanut Butter working together, even if it was for one episode while Todd tried to get back to the office. But Mr. Peanut Butter, I feel like he had surprisingly his most introspective season, even though he didn't intend to. He had to have literally someone tell him what he should be learning about himself. But it's also surprising, because you would think that last season when he was running for a political position, that would cause him to take a longer, harder look at himself. But I really feel like this is the season where we found out the most about him, specifically that Halloween episode where push came to shove and Diane vocalized to him, like, the reason why you're now on your fourth major relationship in the past 25 years or so is because, much like Matthew McConaughey, which he references, girls keep growing up and he keeps staying the same.
Yeah, and in with the political subplot, it almost isn't surprising, I think, that he doesn't reach any position of introspection, because he's surrounded by sycophants on one side and people who basically have to work for him, or he's enlisted to work on his behalf, and also his ideological opponents. And neither of them are in a good place to offer any commentary that will actually get through to him and give him the hard truths that he needs to hear. Whereas this season, when you think he's returned to more of a normal existence, somebody could maybe have that difficult heart-to-heart with him. And people try at various points throughout the season. And eventually, after brushing all of them off with his usual kind of shallow positivity, he eventually has this realization, this kind of Jesus moment that, kind of like BoJack does, I'm the problem, you know, and I have to change if this is going to change. And it remains to be seen, as always, if he will change, but that is the first step. So it's nice to see him finally, at long last, take that.
Like, I got lured into the same thing, to the same headspace Mr. Peanut Butter was in, because during that Halloween episode, I was like, oh, it really, like, hit home to me, like, oh, he's actually found someone he's compatible with in Pickles. Like, this makes sense. This relationship makes sense. And then I realized, again, when Diane tells him at the end, like, yeah, Pickles is like this now, but she's young and she's, like, carefree. Life changes people. And, like, with years, she's not going to be the same anymore. She's going to grow up. And if you don't grow up, too, you're going to find yourself where you've been before. And I really, like, and I don't think anyone's the problem, quote unquote, but I really did think, like, he was just in these relationships with people that he just wasn't compatible with. And he found someone he was. But no, he's just, they're going to change, which is something they also, I think, touched on a little bit this season, which she sort of says, like, everyone's who they are now, but life changes people and they're going to be the same in a few years. At the same time, I also think that the natural changing of people is a good thing, or people, I mean, characters, obviously, in this case. The changing of characters is over time in a natural way is good. At the beginning, though, I guess going back to Todd's storyline, when Yolanda with the very beginning, she's sort of trying to change him. She doesn't, like, she's like, why are you directionless in life? She sort of wants him to be a different person than who he is. And part of that is because he's not happy with her, but she has no other options. But I did think it was interesting that this idea of, like, you want to make someone into the person that they aren't. And this idea that, like, how much does someone really change over time? Because BoJack and Gina's relationship sort of changes too. And he sort of, like, kind of wears her down in a non-bad sense. Just sort of, like, she adapts more to this idea of being in a relationship when she's sort of adamantly against it at the beginning. These ideas of how naturally people change over time and how much you can sort of, I guess, push someone to change, or in Mr. Peanut Butter's case, he would like them to stay the same. He would like them to not change. I didn't think that was interesting, the sort of parallel there.
There's a really fun moment in the end of the Halloween episode when, again, Diane sort of brings him to this revelation. When he realizes, I mean, Pickles literally vocalizes, like, I never want to grow up. And now Mr. Peanut Butter realizes that the situation has reversed, right? That he's starting to sort of, something is broken in his mind, the visage shattered, and he's now realizing, like, oh, crap. I would like to grow up. I am grown up, and I am with someone who doesn't want to necessarily grow up. I loved Pickles as well. Like, I loved how, I mean, her and Mr. Peanut Butter really have similar personalities, that they're a really good fit for each other. But the show did a nice job of saying, maybe to the point of, like, the asexuality stuff, like, just because if you connect on one personality facet, it doesn't necessarily mean that a meaningful relationship is going to happen down the road. And it was also interesting to get a lot I feel like there was so much weight in Peanut Butter's decision not only to sleep with Diane, but also to not tell Pickles about it. And not only that, but double down and propose to her. I can only assume it's going to be catastrophe from there on out. But as Mr. Peanut Butter vocalizes in that final episode, you know, he's a people pleaser. He doesn't want to make anybody upset. And even though he's learned this thing about himself, much like we talked about at the very beginning of this podcast, there's only, you know, you take steps back. You revert to things that make you feel more comfortable. And in that moment, he did. He was about to out a very soul-shattering fact, but instead he decided to completely reverse course and make her the happiest pug in the world and propose to her right there, right now.
He's like a happy Henry VIII, which is a series of failed marriages that can only end disaster. But that lesson that sharing personality traits doesn't mean that the two of you are compatible, I think is one that is very important to learn and that he hasn't learned yet. And maybe this marriage with Pickles ending in disaster, as I think we all expect it will, is going to finally be the thing that jolts them into realizing that. I think that is one of his personality traits, that he's unwilling to engage in that kind of introspection and to realize those things about himself. And while it's true that people do change and that's fine, that's a natural, healthy part of life, and it can be true that, you know, your best friend from high school or your partner from high school, maybe you were right for each other then, but where you are in your lives now, you're not. And that's fine. That's okay. It doesn't mean that it's a personal failing on either one from either one of you.
And the other thing that I thought was interesting about Mr. Peanut Butter is at the Halloween party, you see that he's basically given direct instructions by all of his wives. Like, don't leave me alone. Don't let me see a mummy. Like, they basically tell him exactly what they want. And he just sort of, like, exactly what they need from him at this party. And he sort of just is oblivious to it. He can't keep it in his mind long enough to, like, follow through on it.
I'll give him credit for the mummy thing though, because he actively tried to go for that, but his open page notebook costume ended up failing him with the sliding door.
I agree. That was just piling on. He did his best, but I do think it's interesting that he is a people pleaser. At the same time, that whole episode was just about him repeatedly letting people, these women, down, and I think that's what it comes down to, is a lot of the times people who are people pleasers or people who feel like they have to serve others, he doesn't, even when he's specifically told, he doesn't really understand what they need or what they want. And it, even in the episode, the second episode where Diane goes to Vietnam, he's trying to be supportive of her when they're talking, and then he's like, oh, I can come get you at the airport. Which is kind of a weird thing to say. Like, it's an example of him thinking he's being helpful and supportive, but not realizing, like, the actual truth of the situation. She's trying to go get away from it all and sort of reboot and clear her head. And the last thing she probably wants to see when she gets back is her newly divorced ex-husband. Like, it's just this unawareness, and I guess part of Mr. Peanut Butter's character, but it also does say something like, he really does have good intentions, but he doesn't have sort of the cognitive ability to really see what people need in the moment. And that's what seems to be leading him astray almost as much as the fact that he's dating all these younger people.
And that he's doing the exact same things over and over again and not necessarily realizing, hoping beyond hope, like, yep, this will be the marriage. This will be the one that works out. Not realizing that much like the sitcom, Mr. Peanut Butter's House, that he was a part of for so many years, it's always going to end the same way and begin the same way again.
So let's go on to the other half recently broken up marriage, and that's Diane, who, as you said, Mike, I think is the... But BoJack is still the titular character, as he would never fail to remind us, but Diane maybe is the heart of this season of BoJack, and the one who, if you read a lot of the comments online, she comes under a lot of criticism for delivering what I think are fairly obvious truths to BoJack and other characters about their own behavior, even if she herself needs someone to sit her down and have similar conversations sometimes.
Yeah, but I mean, that's also like, I know I'm a person who does that as well. I am able to like dispense advice to other people, but I'm not able to self-diagnose myself, which is why it's always important to have someone in your life to do that. But the show off, first off, in the first episode, we get Diane with a completely different haircut and no explanation as to why when Mr. Peanut Butter picks her up. And we get this explanation in episode two, which is a few of the experimental episodes done this season. I really like the second episode, how it was framed via her listicle, yes, of 10 reasons to visit Vietnam, and how it judged all these timelines as well. It was fractured storytelling, but it sort of flowed in a way. And I mean, it also faced headfirst into something that Raphael Bob Wachsberg has sort of, I think it's probably his biggest regret with BoJack up to this point, was sort of like, haphazardly casting an actor of Caucasian descent to play a Vietnamese American. And there's some really meta aspects where you see Diane dressing herself in Nguyen clothes, literally looking in the mirror and saying, you know, she felt like she was wearing a costume. She wasn't really herself. There's some really interesting introspective moments there, not even just with Diane's character, but outside of that. But she has this fantastic monologue at the end of the episode about how, you know, you are completely adrift with no compass or map or sense of where to go. So you go to Vietnam, you think you might have a community, a sense of connection to something bigger, but you don't. In fact, you feel more alone than you did before you left, but you survive. You learn that you could survive being alone. And going back to what we said at the beginning of the podcast, it's interesting how this scene is talking about her inexorable link between her and BoJack, their codependency on each other. But her revelation in this moment from her trip is, you know, I am essentially alone in the world, and that's okay. She's unintentionally taking Butterscotch's advice right now of, you know, I have no one to rely on but myself, and that's relieving in a manner of speaking.
And this is another of those episodes which, when you see the fan reaction, you realize just how many people the show itself, but this specific episode, has resonated with. So you saw lots of people saying that, to use Diane's example, like, when I'm in America, I'm Asian, and when I'm American, and either I feel like I'm out of place in my own country, or when I go back to what other people seem to think is my own country, I feel like a tourist. And there's a sense of not really belonging anywhere in particular that really feels disorienting and dissatisfying on some level.
And it is interesting, because at the point when, I don't think I'm getting this out of order, but at the point when Diane goes to Vietnam, And she sort of realizes at the end of the episode, I'm alone and I can be okay with that. Like, I do think, like, she realizes focusing on herself a little bit and not being so dependent on other people, specifically BoJack, is a good thing. But at that point, she doesn't know about New Mexico yet. Like, she hasn't heard any of it,
no.
I think. Right. So it's interesting that even at that moment when their relationship really isn't that tense, like, there is a little bit of tension over, like, this sort of residual tension that's hard to explain when he sort of tries to give her a compliment. She doesn't take it well, and he's like, he's continued, they're not on the same page, they're not communicating well, and he doesn't understand why she can't just take the compliment. There's some tension, but, like, the root of the tension hasn't obviously come up yet, and it's interesting that even at the moment she sort of does realize that she's, oh, like, there's good things to being alone, and there's, like, there's a way to handle that, and I think it's good that they let her have that moment about, be about herself, and not about, I need to get away from BoJack because he did this thing and I need to, like, process it. The moment realizing that was about herself, and it just happened to impact her relationships around her rather than being about, this guy did this terrible thing and I need to get away from it. It had more layers to it.
But then it ties interestingly back into episode 4 when she sort of gets brought in, because like you said, I think Diane is sort of the beating heart slash the audience analog. So when we sort of do our big requisite quote unquote issues episode, you know, she was part of the abortion one and the gun control one. And now she's part of Me Too one as well, where she literally diagrams out, you know, what normalizing is, where I think she had talked about being alone, but she sort of serves as like the voice of a community from that perspective, where she unfairly vocalizes just like how tired she is with dealing with, you know, what it's like to be a woman in the media today. And she decides, going back to this relationship with BoJack, it's sort of is functioning in this very awkward way. It's like that machine where you're like, I don't know how it's running right now. It's running on springs and rubber bands, but it's running somehow. But it all ends up snapping when it turns out that, you know, Diane had sort of really been supporting BoJack as this quote-unquote good guy and this male feminist, etc. And then she gets this information, and BoJack has this really interesting final line in that recording where he says, how do you make something right when you've made it so wrong you can never go back? And that's essentially the entire episode, right? That's the talk about, like, Me Too and Time's Up and everything, is these guys have done monstrously wrongs in their lives. But for the most part, people, at the end of the day, after time passes, things usually tend to come back around. And essentially, you know, it's making things right when they've done something wrong so long ago. And Diane is sort of horror struck that her best friend is one of these people. And it's sort of just, I don't know, it cracks something within her head. Between that and BoJack telling her in the psychiatrist episode, like, oh, we're the same, I think that's the straw that breaks the camel's back. I'm surprised that BoJack has not a little joke like that, by the way, so far with a literal camel. But it's what causes her to pen that submarine scene where things really start to break in a different direction for their relationship.
And I'm sure you, Mike, along with the rest of us, were very glad that when the two of them trying to comfort each other and take solace in each other, that it doesn't escalate into anything romantic. And I know not just because a lesser show would almost certainly go to that space, and you and Misha have in the past, but also because we know as viewers who are rooting for these people to become better, that there is no way that can possibly end well for either one of them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I feel like, and maybe this is me just putting a lot of optimism and hope into the writing staff. I feel like after that one scene in the underground episode in season 4, where like, the two of them got drunk together and just sort of like became honest about like their relationship, I don't think we're ever going to see that, which makes me happy. I do feel like one of the weaker points of season 1 was sort of BoJack sort of fruitlessly pursuing Diane, even if it did great, give us the fantastic Hollywood runner that now spans 5 seasons. I felt like it was a bit tropey, so I'm happy that we're not going that direction, because to your point, it's a very like sitcom level thing. It would be very like Sam and Diane, quite literally, because one of the characters has the same name.
Very good. But going back to Diane's journey to Vietnam, as you said, Mike, this is something which I know Raphael Bob Baxberg still feel strongly about, and he went on this apology tour of sorts pre-season, accounting for the fact that if I could go back and do this over again, either I would keep Alison Brie, because who wouldn't want Alison Brie on their show, but cast her as a white character, or cast a Vietnamese actress in the role of Diane and have some other role there for Alison Brie. And he said that at the time, he was aware that this would seem controversial or that there was something out of order about this. So he was acknowledging his own awareness of that and his own culpability. It wasn't just born out of ignorance. But this episode does feel like an attempt to atone for that original sin of the show. This does feel like a nod to that conversation that Raphael Bob Waxberg is having with himself, but also with the audience as well. And I know he said in the past he felt that having Alison Brie voicing Diane was linked for his own writing process, because the character of Diane in this universe would definitely want to talk about identity and explore that as an issue. But he felt uncomfortable writing that in for Diane, for Alison Brie, because of that disconnect. And that led to the character of Diane kind of acting inconsistently in a way that you wouldn't expect for someone who does work for Girl Crush and who is very attuned to these issues.
Yeah, and another, in case people didn't know this, a little, I don't want to say Easter egg, because he is trying to address a mistake he made, but a little thing they did in the Vietnam episode was there's a rude tourist she's talking to, a white American tourist who mistakes her for being, like, native from Vietnam, and is talking to her like she doesn't understand English, and she's trying to explain that she does, and it's a funny scene. But the American actor is actually played by Randall Park, who is Asian American, and it was pretty funny. I didn't realize that. There's nothing distinct about the performance. I just looked it up afterwards. I think that was the interesting nod to that little, what's hard to touch on in the episode, of feeling like when you're an American or an Asian American, no matter where you are, you don't really feel like you're with your people. I think that was a fun way of addressing it.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I'm really glad I do now, because that puts it in a bit of a different light. But you also had this nod to another part of that experience of this fling with the American tourist, who is the literal embodiment of Americanness as the bald eagle, who takes an interest in Diane, but only as this kind of platonic ideal of the kind of exotic foreign beauty that he meets on his travels, and not as a real person with real thoughts and feelings. And she kind of plays into it and goes along with it at first, until they realize that, like, this is so fundamentally shallow, and that you are literally just playing into a stereotype here. You are being the trope of the ignorant traveler who just sees the world as his plaything.
Yeah, I called it his Miss Saigon role play.
Yeah, and it's, again, ties really nicely into Princess Carolyn, that, like, she, the whole purpose of the trip was that she was realizing, like, all these things she was putting on were not really herself, and she was trying to sort of be something for somebody else. She was the wife to Mr. Peanut Butter, you know, she was the friend to BoJack, she was this one-night mysterious non-English-speaking lover to this eagle grip working on the set of this new movie. It's so interesting, again, how both of these characters who go on geographic journeys sort of learn the same thing about themselves, but how they sort of deviate in different ways. And Diane, you know, again, going back to this idea of how she is independent, but I feel like she bears a lot of the moral weight that comes with Filbert when she's brought on, to the point where that quote that I mentioned before was her at the premiere being like, oh crap, I didn't realize that essentially what I was writing was normalizing this behavior and encouraging people to empathize with them. I don't want this to get shown.
Yeah, and to go back to the representation issue around Alison Brie and Diane, it's curious that in a world which you think would be more ripe for that kind of conversation with this animal sub-universe, if you will, the implications of that are never really explored fully, and that adds to the comic absurdity of BoJack, that it's just taken for granted that, of course, you're going to have actual humans side by side with horses and fish and everything else under the sun. But equally, you would think that in a show where the natural format, the very nature of the universe, makes it easier to confront those kind of issues, that there's no kind of in-depth dive into that. So we don't get, for instance, what it means to be a cat or a horse within the BoJack Horseman universe, or whether being a horse and also or being a cat and having the same issue around belonging as Diane does in this episode, whether that adds this like secondary layer to it. In a way, the show is uniquely well suited or uniquely poorly suited to handling that issue, given the way that it sets itself up initially.
I mean, they've dealt with it a smidge before. Like, one of the reasons why I think what drove a wedge between Princess Carolyn and Ralph was her family celebrating what that holiday, right, where like they killed the cats and they relish over it.
Sure.
BoJack ended season two or ended season three / began season four trying to run the wild horses, which was interesting. I'm surprised that we didn't pursue that a bit more, because I do agree that there's some interesting like taxonomy going on where like the chickens can't speak and the bears can't speak for some reason. I don't know. It gets into the whole like why is Goofy anthropomorphic but Pluto isn't. Really makes your head hurt sometimes.
They did have a little background clip of a pig in the restaurant where Pickles is a waitress, and he's horrified because they're eating pork. It is funny. I do think I read a Vulture interview, and he did seem to be implying that he's nervous to touch on these things, because, like you said, the show's either incredibly well-suited for it or not, and he's nervous to, like, deem any one group of people as an animal and sort of have people discussing the implications of what that says about these people. I think he did seem to say that that was something he was concerned about getting into too much.
It does get woven into the episode in some fairly amusing ways. So when Stefani tells Diane that some cockroaches in IT tried to unionize by calling an exterminator, it's like, if that was just a conventional labor dispute, it wouldn't have the same resonance. But that is a very vivid way of introducing that to the audience. Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
No, I was just going to say, I think there was even like an Easter egg, right, where like there was a shrine like Gone Bernard. Like, they checked in, but they didn't check out, with like pictures of the IT people on it. Pretty dark, but it's one of those fantastic Simpsons-esque blink and you miss it freeze frame gags.
That might be the best job in journalism, of just watching BoJack on slow motion trying to identify all of the things that you missed the first time around. One other thing I did like is Diane is back in the US. We see that her living quarters are not the best, some would say. In so many of these shows, living in LA as a writer or as this kind of hip young person is presented as this very glamorous thing, right? So, you know, Friends is the canonical example. I don't know how they're able to afford that apartment, but somehow they are. And it's never really explained over the course of many, many episodes. But realistically, if you are someone in Diane's position and you're working in this, which increasingly there is more competition for jobs and fewer jobs to go around, and even if you can land a gig somewhere, it's either unsatisfying, like the Girl Crush gig, or it's precarious. You don't know what's coming in day to day or how you're going to pay your rent at the end of the month. And so seeing Diane in this shitty apartment, as Shane Powers might say, it feels much more real than so many other treatments of that in most shows.
That being said, Stefani does give this proposition to Diane at the end, which warrants the conversation we talked about before, where Girl Crush is, of course, in true media fashion, orienting towards video footage. And so they want to say, Diane, we want to make you the face of it. Do we think that's where we're going to go? We did hear Diane do a podcast for Girl Crush that Pickles and Mr. Peanut Butter overheard on their way to see the space station get blown up. But do we think Diane, after all the BoJack stuff, is going to accept that offer at the end of the day, and we're going to see her become more of like the literal face of the company?
I actually think so, yeah. I think they'll want to tap into that.
With Diane, it's impossible to talk about this season without talking about her relationship with BoJack. I know we've touched on it before, but it's impossible to really touch upon it enough. So where's best to dive in with all of that? Because we could spend hours on it, but what do you think is the natural lead in there?
Interior sub, or we could say, like, start with the blow-up they had at the Philbert premiere and then just sort of blow up there with the concentric circles. Because I think that it takes place before and after that, but that is probably one of the most, like, brutal verbal shakedowns we've had in the show's history thus far. Well, it was honest, but it was brutal, and it was also this very scary moment when BoJack grabs Diane a bit too hard, and she's like, please let go, you're hurting me. And he does let go, and he sort of realizes it for a second, but it's actually a really great setup to what's going to happen in episode 11. He ends up, you know, going completely ham and just not realizing his own strength. But I mean, it's a conversation that, like, was simmering so much underneath the surface, especially all of the Phoenix stuff. And so to hear him, you know, BoJack brings it up, but you hear him try to skew it in this way of, like, you know, this wouldn't have happened. She was the age of consent anyway. But all he needs to say that, like, completely satiates Diane is he basically says, like, well, he implies, you know, had someone not walked in, something probably would have happened. And you think that would be, like, a point of no return for the relationship. It still might be. We don't know how they're ending things. But, I mean, it was something that needed to be said. But it was just a knockdown, a drag-out, like, 5 minutes to end the episode. And while it was almost cleansing to see after these two characters held such intense feelings towards each other, especially Diane towards BoJack, it was rough to watch.
From the time she initially finds out to her avoiding talking about it and him avoiding talking about it to this argument, it feels like it had been a while, at least in the number of episodes. And part of me was like not actually concerned that she wouldn't talk about it. I knew they were going to address it, obviously. But that feeling of like when you sort of empathize with a show, and my feeling of like, honestly, nothing actually happened. Like, maybe I could just pretend I never heard it and just try to like let it go and not get into a confrontation about it, which is sort of like how I was feeling. I was like, I know she has to talk about it, but like, I was actually feeling this feeling of dread of this confrontation coming up. And so when they actually did start talking about it, it obviously had to be said. But it was really intense to listen to. And I think that they did a good job with him and her both addressing that she feels like she's enabled this sort of behavior by teaching him about how to be a feminist when it's all just an act, and by helping to give this character of Filbert more depth when really it's gone too far. And now people are relating to him and thinking it's okay to act this way because of what he says during during the speech at the premiere, which is like, if we're all terrible, then everyone's fine. And she really feels, I think, more than anything, as much as she says she sort of is okay with being alone, she really does take on a lot of responsibility for other people's behavior, for the lessons people are taking away from what she's done. And a lot that it's interesting because it does stand in contrast to the way these anti-hero stories are written. I think we're trying to say that's happening because they have a woman involved, and she sort of has the history within herself and her own life experience to know that this behavior is wrong, whereas a lot of the guys are willing to overlook it. But I did think it was interesting. She just felt so, she asks him if he feels guilty, and it seems like she herself feels very guilty for having just allowed him to get away with this behavior. And the fact that he never told her and she couldn't address it when it happened, it almost felt like she felt guilty for that. Like, if she had just known right away, she could have like done more to get him back on the right course. She really is very codependent.
Yeah, one thing that stands out as you watch the show is that, and it's true of some other characters too, but especially Diane, you don't have any other close friends outside of the central set of the BoJack cast, and especially no close female friends. And you wonder if the people that she needs to have in her life, the ones who she can rightfully occupy that high ground over and try to fix or work on as some kind of project, and that if someone were to enter her life who was just fairly normal and functional and had it all going on, she wouldn't quite know how to react to that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's an infinitely complicated relationship, and I love it just because I think we initially thought, like, I don't know, at least when I was first watching the show, I thought it was going to be BoJack and Princess Carolyn were certainly going to be the, not won't they, but like constant ebbs and flows to their relationship. But it really turns out that the two of them are, because again, as independent as Diane seems to make her seem, BoJack's the one who gave her this opportunity onto the show. She's the one who decides to out BoJack through the interior sub scene, which the interior sub episode I'm okay on. I can't say I was a big fan of like the, as much as I love Issa Rae and Wanda Sykes, I wasn't a big fan of their framing device of like everything's, you know, kooky. I guess it makes sense once you hear Diane's final line about how, you know, it's a story I heard once, I just changed all the names. But I wasn't a huge fan of the storytelling device until that final scene, which is pretty gripping, that basically Diane scripts out essentially BoJack's confession that was Anna Spanakopita recorded. It makes BoJack have to speak the words that he's, you know, probably ruminated on so many nights. It was, again, another hard-to-watch moment, but considering that this has sort of been an unspoken moment that has lived in show for the past 3 years, I'm happy that it finally came to the surface, because it is, in a manner of speaking, a trauma for him. And to have it sort of be a ghost without necessarily getting acknowledged, much like Fritz, it's a bit criminal.
And I've seen criticism of Diane as taking that trauma and throwing it in BoJack's face of really turning that back on him. But over the course of their relationship over many years, she has tried so many approaches to get BoJack to confront the reality of his own behavior, whether it's the softly-softly approach, trying to reason with him and explain things. She's gone through the entire spectrum and tried all of these different things. And this, I think, is a genius way of forcing him to of escalating it and forcing him to actually confront it without making it public. Because if you make it public, then you're speaking on behalf of the people who are wronged by BoJack. And as Gina says in that final episode, I don't want you to be the most notable thing that happened to me or the most notable thing about me. And if she makes it public, she's making that call on behalf of Penny and on behalf of other people. So this is a nice way of making that statement in a way which still has an effect, but which only has that effect on BoJack and on the handful of people who actually know the backstory there.
I think it was, I agree. I think it was smart, and I think it, the way it played out in the episode, it was pretty chilling, honestly. And I did want to just go back to, we sort of addressed the argument, I guess, more from Diane's perspective, but I just want to say they did something I really liked with BoJack in that scene, in that before that moment when they get into the confrontation, he did genuinely feel bad. You can tell about it when he talked about it initially, and you can tell since then it's really weighed on him, and it is something he felt guilt and shame and remorse over how he should be feeling. But I did like and found very telling about the human condition, quote unquote, that as soon as she called him out for it, got really defensive, started making excuses for himself, saying all the old, all the sort of cliche lines of she was the age of consent, all this, and saying he didn't actually do anything, so it doesn't count, and just immediately kind of turning it back on her, saying are you enjoying my face, kind of making himself seem less culpable. And it is interesting that no matter how bad he felt before and how it seemed to really weigh on him, when people are confronted and sort of put on the back foot, they do sort of lash out in that way and can't really, a lot of people just aren't capable of being held accountable when they feel like they're being judged.
Yeah. I mean, and BoJack's so interesting in that he really is all or nothing, because cut to, when he ends up abusing Gina on set. And at that point he is overboard, understandably so, but he's I'm a horrible person, I shouldn't have done this, I need to fess up. And compare that to him sort of writing off, essentially, even though it is the age of consent, statutory rape, he doesn't really have this middle ground of him being I do some bad things, but I do some good things as well, which is really the message that Diane tries to impart on him at the end. For him, it's either I was fine still doing things for good reasons, or my God, I'm the scum of the earth, I should just die right now.
Well, I think this is cognitive dissonance of him pushing back based on how other people are reacting, because Diane is very, is shaming him for what he's done, rightfully so, and she's angry and she's pointing out all the ways when it was wrong, and he's sort of pushing back again and defending himself. But after the incident with Gina, obviously no one thinks it's okay, but they're all about business, and so they're all making excuses and doing these fake interviews to make it seem no, nothing to see here. And he's sort of pushing back against that, too, and saying, no, there is something to see here. What I did was really, really wrong. Because no one's pushing him, he's pushing back in the opposite way.
And he does argue that he is the person who has suffered the most through his own actions, that so many of the people that he's wronged in the past have probably moved about it now or don't remember it, whereas he is still stricken with guilt and has to relive all of those moments and live with the consequences of what he's done. And you almost want that to be true. You want the people who have suffered through interacting with BoJack to move on and not still be consumed by those memories and those experiences. And in a way, you want BoJack to feel guilty about it, because you hope that would be the first step on fixing that and not acting that way in the future. And yet you don't want to concede that point to BoJack, because that just gives him an excuse to be self-pitying and not face up to his own actions again.
Yeah, I mean, the penultimate episode is really representative of that, right? Where he finds this note under his door that he thinks is threatening, and he essentially creates a laundry list of people that he feels like would hold grudges against them. And some of them are understandable. But I feel like, you know, and I can't, you know, quote the song perfectly, but isn't there a line that Gina sings about how, like, there's, he's surrounded by people at all times? So I think he basically feels the things that he's done are spirits that haunt him at all times, even if it might not necessarily be reciprocal.
Yeah, let's transition, I guess, to something which is very tied in with this, and that's Diane's relationship with the show Filbert, because she is brought in as this consultant as Flip's way of, again, making issues without having to actually do anything. Just the fact that Diane is there is meant to reassure the people who would be criticizing the show otherwise. And I think her dilemma over whether to engage with Filbert, it mirrors the one that she has with BoJack, and that many of us have with these people in our lives, of, well, this currently is a very flawed situation or a flawed thing. Do I want to be the person to think that I can improve it and to try and improve it, or do I want to disassociate myself with it altogether and not be tarred by association there? And with Diane, she goes along with it, but then quickly finds that it is an act, that had no intention of reforming the show, and that by being part of it, she can do her best to, and maybe she does it too well to reform the show, but ultimately she will be seen as like this arbiter of the show's moral value.
Yeah, I mean, there's an exchange between her and BoJack in the fourth episode where she says, "I can't change anything." BoJack says, "You changed me." So yeah, it's very similar where she, with that courage, is able to say, like, okay, let me play my own psychiatrist role and try to make the Filbert a better person. But as we talked about before, it all sort of gets twisted, topsy-turvy, and of course received in the completely opposite way than what she intended.
And I do think it's interesting, she makes what I think is the decision that we want to serve, decision in the sense of, like, if you can make something better and you have an opportunity to reach more people than she would ever writing her column, why not do it? But at the same time, it's not even that she's being held, like, she's honestly more than anyone holding herself responsible for the message that's being taken away from people watching Filbert. But there's also this idea of, if something is so rotten that it's going to fail, then maybe we'll die a natural death and start again on something new. Like, when these shows, House of Cards or Roseanne, for example, have these big controversies with their stars, there really is, like, this, they've attempted to salvage both of those shows, and they have done for at least one more season, by just removing the problematic element and hoping to rebuild from there. But I think at the same time, there is something to be said about burning it down and starting fresh with new blood. And being, you can hire the same, like, not all the same people, but, like, there can be jobs for these people on a new show that doesn't have the baggage that this old show has. And I think they have questioning her decision at the end, and I think that's the right way to go about it. If you're going to try and approach a storyline from both angles, is have the character make a decision and then also give them to reflect on if they made the wrong decision. And I think they did a good job with that.
What do you both think that Diane's obligations or decisions are with regard to BoJack? Because the position of someone, a friend of this disgraced figure, is very different from the position of that person or of the public at large, who have no vested interest in seeing any particular outcome happen to them. So in Diane's case, she knows that she is very close, incredibly flawed character, but that character relies on her in many ways for guidance or for support or for just friendship in general. So what do you think her situation is, and what do you make of the way that she handles it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm hopeful that she takes Stefani's words to heart and essentially puts less pressure on her. That's another situation that I sympathize with all too well, this idea that, like, for some reason you judge yourself more harshly than you judge others because you say, "I should know better," for some strange reason, and realize that you are just a person. So I hope, for my own therapeutic stake, that she does sort of take that advice. And I hope that she also realizes that, like, I do understand her concern about, like, what will people say, how will people judge her in being linked to someone who is so problematic. But again, going back to Stefani's words, does that necessarily make her a bad person? It really shouldn't. It should just make her a person. So I'm hoping that we get a more mellowed out Diane from now on, I don't think that's necessary. That's probably not going to happen, especially if she becomes a larger role in the media. And that was, of course, a lot of criticism. But I think that this was an important step, at least in her own self-esteem, to realize, like, I should not be coming into everything so headstrong. You're fighting the right battles, but you're almost, like, not putting armor on yourself. You know, you're walking into the middle of a battlefield saying, yep, stab at me, I should be stabbed, when essentially she should be able to put on as much armor as she wants to.
I think for me, ideally, again, this is BoJack, so it probably won't go exactly this way, but the ideal outcome for someone like Diane would be to not basically take on so much of what he did wrong as her problem. Like, she really internalizes everything, and she is involved with some of it, but she feels a lot of responsibility for these decisions he made and the fact that he never told her about them. And she feels a lot of responsibility for teaching him about feminism and having him sort of twist it to make himself look like a good guy. And she feels responsibility for making Gilbert show something people could use to excuse their bad behavior. And I think she needs to, like, in a sense, give herself a break in that regard and realize that, like, in a way, all you can do is help as much as possible, but at a certain point, people are responsible for their own actions. Other people involved in the show are responsible for their actions as well. At the same time, I do think that she can be friends with BoJack going forward if she feels like forgiving him. I don't think she should feel obligated to hate him forever, because I don't think that your personal relationship with someone who's done bad things is different than the relationship of the person they did that to. And specifically in the example of these celebrities who are doing bad things, her relationship with him should be different than the audience, both like us watching at home and then like the people watching Philbert, like the people who know him as a celebrity. Her reaction is allowed to be different. It just because she forgives him privately doesn't mean he deserves this big redemption tour publicly. They can be separate things. And I think that would be a good direction for her character to take. Maybe his career doesn't go back to normal, but if she forgives him and he makes peace with that, I think that could be interesting.
Does keeping that friendship imply some kind of acceptance or support, though? Because for these people who have done these things, clearly there's already an empathy gap of some kind, that they aren't understanding their own responsibilities towards other people and the needs of those people. And being told the same things over and over again, that this is why what you did is wrong, is not going to have an impact. Whereas actually being cast out by the people who they do care about, the people who are in their inner circle, is maybe most likely way of reforming them. But then on the other hand, if all of the people who understand why what they did is wrong are leaving, and the only voices in that person's ear now are the ones who don't realize that, or who are maybe on some level okay with it, then that doesn't seem like a good outcome either.
Yeah, I think that this is the season where BoJack's behavior has verged the most on self-destructive. And so if I were personally in Diane's position, I would want to say, like, no matter what, you have to make sure that you're his connection, you know, that you're his contact, because we've seen he has pushed literally everyone else away, even the one family member that we thought he had by the end of the season four. He ends up sort of, even though I feel like she's still going to be there for him because she's awesome, he still pushed her away by like spending the entire night going on a push for pills, basically. And I feel like, you know, she gets stuff out of that as well. I think she still does enjoy his company at the end of the day. They do connect on a certain level that she really doesn't with any of the other characters. So I do not think she's going to spurn him at the end of the day. I feel like her dropping him off at rehab, being the only person to do so, is extremely emblematic. And also her being the only person he told, "I need help," which are three of the most powerful words that BoJack has said in five seasons, I think speaks volumes as well as to the level of trust and commitment he has to their relationship.
And I also think that it kind of comes up a lot in these ideas of recovery from addiction, is you can let a person hit rock bottom, and in some ways that might be the thing that they need. I think she can let him do that, let him realize, because when you let them do that, it's like the one thing they realize that, like, they're coming back from this. You have to make a change. There's no more exceptions going to be made on your behalf. And I think that she can sort of I don't know if she, if that's the way the show is going, but she could do that. And then after he sort of quote unquote learned his lesson and really tried to atone and realize that his actions aren't okay, then she can slowly kind of reintegrate him back into her life, which might be an approach they could take.
Because from the outside, I imagine there are people within the media unit of BoJack who are saying, well, look, BoJack can't be that bad. Someone who is woke, as they would put it, someone who is very conscious of the effects of people's actions in Diane, is still willing to be friends with him. And clearly she wouldn't do that, knowing what she knows, if she felt that he was beyond redemption or that he wasn't worth associating with. And I don't know how much she should have to take ownership of that, but do you think that she has a responsibility to acknowledge that?
Honestly, no, probably not. But I think the expectation will be that she does, and that'll be how it'll come about on the show. Is she'll probably feel a lot of pressure to explain why he can be forgiven, what atone. And I think a lot of it, I guess if it was the real world, would fall on her to explain why she's friends with him or why she was able to forgive him. At the same time, I think, I want to be careful about how I say this, but I feel like at a certain point, people are going to be forgiven for a lot of things. Like a lot of people have done things, big and small, and we'll look at them at the end of the day. And the whole, at some point, someone is going to forgive them. You can't really say that they're wrong. If two people have made their peace with something and reparations have been made in other ways, if people decide that they want to be friends, I think that in the non-celebrity world, it would just be let it be and leave it alone. I do think that the show does run into a complication because I do think that them being public figures will have them held to a higher level of accountability and under more scrutiny. But I think you're right. It is kind of a tricky situation.
And maybe that is a limit that the show necessarily has to run up against, that because it is a show in LA about celebrities, about watch up celebrities in BoJack's case, that they are dealing with public figures, and that the questions surrounding that are maybe different if it's just people in some small social circle somewhere who are not known to anybody outside of that. And it's a different dynamic going on, possibly.
Yeah. I mean, I think, like you said, the fact that they're going to be in the public eye might say something. We're not entirely sure. I still don't know at this point. Like, I think the show is so intrinsically drawn to these main five characters that we actually don't know too much about, like, how the people on the street feel about BoJack, considering like all the stuff that BoJack has gone through in the past 5 years, where like he was in a movie that was garnering Oscar buzz and he was in this reboot of a show that suddenly got canceled. Now he's in this critically acclaimed drama. Like, I'd be really intrigued to see, you know, if they interviewed human animals just walking the streets of Hollywood, what their personal thoughts on BoJack Horseman would be. Because we know his thoughts about himself and we know his friends' thoughts about him, but we don't know anything about like what the actual people think about him as a celebrity.
He is trapped within this bubble where he, for as much as he wants to be recognized by the public at large, he doesn't need to interact with them. He can always retreat to his mansion or perch precariously on the side of the hill somewhere. And that's, you know, going back to Diane's situation, that's kind of what I liked about that, that for as much as BoJack is struggling with a lot of very serious issues, he does have this retreat that he can come back to. It's a different experience when you're maybe Diane, who is going through a lot of the same shit that BoJack is, but on top of that is wondering how she's going to avoid getting evicted by her landlord in 2 weeks' time. On that topic of forgiveness, we never get to hear from Penny, for instance. We don't hear from many of the other people littered throughout BoJack's past, lying there in the wreckage of BoJack's poor decisions over the past few decades. So there's this question of forgiveness as an individual act, if you're the person who has been wronged, versus how society at large should treat you and not welcome you back, but come to terms with what you've done and allow you to assume some kind of new role. And Mike, you were saying at the start how it seems like a lot of the disgraced men over the past year or so are gradually clawing their way back up the ladder. So Louis C.K., right now, to date this podcast in October 2018, is going back and doing performances, and in those smaller scenes is being welcomed back, it seems. And you have to imagine things are only going to go up from there. So what stance do you expect the show to take vis-a-vis BoJack himself? So in season 6, when all of this is coming out in public and BoJack is being forced to atone for what he did, is it going to be a gradual process? Or maybe it would mirror reality more effectively if BoJack were able to come back to the same power and prestige that he had before.
I mean, it could also say there could be a completely spun narrative helmed by Princess Carolyn of, look how heroic BoJack is. He recognized his personal demons and he decides to, you know, face them down. Do you realize how many people die from the opioid crisis every year? I could totally see them spin it like that. I mean, on the note of Gina, it's interesting, by the way. I think Stephanie Beatriz wins, like, my MVP of the season. I did not know it was her voice for such a long time just because the role that we usually know her for, which is Rosa Diaz on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, is just my tone that to hear her actually, like, give inflections is so alien. But her sort of dismissal of him, and I'm assuming we're not going to see her again. She might be, like, the Kelsey in BoJack's mind now of, like, people who he's hurt in the past who he'll probably never interact with again, despite it being Hollywood. But it's this idea of, like, forget, don't forgive, where she's essentially saying, like, okay, this is strictly transactional now, even less so than when it started. You know, we're basically done here. Her arc was super interesting because she represented a side of stardom that, like, was cynical but had almost a dream to it. I mean, that's why she sort of has this obsession with this musical, right? Kernel of Truth, that, like, there was this little thing that really sparked performing in her, and even though she's doing her umpteenth procedure, it's still a brass ring that she wants to reach for. And when she sort of, I don't know, when she gets literally manhandled in the process, I think she sort of realizes over the course of filming how, like, maybe she doesn't want to necessarily open herself up to that. So it's another person who BoJack has profoundly affected and has taught an unfortunate lesson about the reality that it can exist sometimes.
I think the show next season could end up with BoJack taking maybe one of the approaches they would take is AA approach and sort of have a scene
step per episode, yeah.
Yeah, or even if they didn't want to go that far with it, I think just, like, specifically focusing on him making amends, which is a big step, and I can see that being a way to address the individual forgiveness or perhaps not receiving forgiveness, because it is different. Like, I think we were saying all podcasts, that his friends forgiving him, who maybe weren't on the receiving end of any of this, is one thing. And the public forgiving him is a totally separate thing. And then the people he's hurt forgiving him is another thing altogether. And that's kind of, especially when it's a public figure, that is sort of where the cues should be taken from. At the same time, the people he hurt, Gina is a public figure, so her acknowledging it is one thing, and she may not want to, but Penny is not. So it could be complicated in that way, but even just for his own sake and for us watching the show to see how he approaches that in, like, with a serious mindset would be interesting, because I think you do see a difference. And in the real world, there's all sort of variations of public apologies being made, but they're very general, like Louis C.K. has definitely made a public apology where he sort of addressed everyone, not by name. And who knows what he's done privately. That's, I guess, for him and the people involved. And then there's people like Uma Thurman and Quentin Tarantino, where the situation was different. They both sort of said, yeah, this was effed up, but we started and we're good. And I do think that he's able to be viewed slightly differently, I guess, depending on who you ask, because of how sort of clear-cut the issues were and the kind of reconciliation was. So I do think they could go, they could sort of try and take that line if they wanted to explore the idea of redemption with him next season.
Yeah, there's a good quote in one of Raphael Bob Raxburg's many interviews about this, saying that when they were conceiving what season 5 would look like initially, this was before the Me Too revelations and the movement really took hold. And so seeing that play out as they were writing the season and filming, I guess, for lack of a better word, the season was kind of surreal in a sense. And they had to adjust the show's treatment of that to some degree based on the way that real life events were unfolding. So they said that there was a line of dialogue along the lines of for Diane saying, these guys get away with everything and nobody cares. And then people, it seemed like, were starting to care about things, and this actually was having consequences for these figures in real life, and so they changed the line to reflect that. But now, a few months along in that news cycle, it feels like those figures are starting to be rehabilitated. And a lot of the time, these revelations come out, and then nothing happens, and we're on to outrage over the next person who's just been outed. And a lot of these people are just continuing in those same positions, having the same level of influence. And so BoJack's treatment of the issue is a snapshot of a moment which it can never capture fully, because no show fully could. And it's actually that moment in time when they were writing it.
And I did think the other thing, just because it is really related to that, is the way they did a good job of showing in episode 4 Vance, when BoJack goes on the show to sort of make an goes on to that, I guess it's The View talk show, to kind of say, oh, I wasn't criticizing him. He's sort of going to sort of toe the company line. And everything he's saying is getting sort of toothily construed as him being in, like, woke about Vance and saying all the right things, even though he's really saying nothing. People are so hungry to, says later, the standard for men is so low that the bare minimum will suffice. And people are so willing to give him the benefit of the doubt and see him as just self-aware and smart and just in touch with what's going on and ready to call out all the other guys. Like, I think they did a good job of highlighting that phenomenon, which is very present also.
Again, because it is a show about public figures, it feels like the real-life conversation about that at the moment, when it deals with the question of how those people can be productive members of society again, it feels like there's this artificial binary setup where, on the one hand, they can keep the status quo, keep their positions, and we just look at them with a little bit more suspicion than we did before. Or there's this, like, Roman-esque banishment from society where they get exiled to some foreign province thousands of miles away and no one ever hears from them again, when we don't have a good sense of what it's going to like for them to just live lives out of the public eye under these new conditions without the same power and wealth and prestige that they had previously. And they're not entitled to those things, firstly, anyway, but secondly, especially after they've been publicly indicted and convicted of such behavior.
Yeah, I it is interesting how, I don't know, it's been a while since I feel like BoJack has never really, I guess maybe since in the very beginning when I was like, BoJack, you know, is against the troops. It's been a while since we've dealt with, like, social media, which it's interesting that it's such a big part of our world today. It's surprising that we don't really, again, because the show is so internal, and that it's these people specifically dealing with each other and their own personal spheres, that we're not really dealing with, like, oh, you know, Twitter's or whatever the equivalent is blowing up because of you. You know, they talked about the possibility of the video leaking with Gina and BoJack, and that's what the interview is about. But I'm surprised we don't lean more on that, you know, considering just how big of a facet the way we consume content is about that today.
Yeah, I guess if there's one other, not criticism necessarily, but observation about the way that BoJack handles these issues, it's that the people who come under scrutiny in the show are BoJack, who, despite what some people online seem to want to think about him, is a highly flawed individual who, and the show has no reservations about expressing that. And then also Vance Wagner, who's this Mel Gibson caricature of a caricature, essentially. But really, the same thing applied to people who, by all public accounts, are, like, well-respected and well-liked, and yet, you know, have this behavior to account for. You think Hippopolis, maybe, but we were shown as the audience that he was actually a scumbag who was, like so many other people on BoJack, putting on this this front. So we haven't had to reckon with a character that we, as the audience, had an attachment to and wanted to believe was better than that and was a good person, whatever that means, who now is coming under criticism for that kind of behavior. So it's almost easy to criticize the people who are guilty of that in the show, and maybe more easy than it should be if it wants to give a full portrayal of those issues.
Yeah, like, what would this storyline be like if it had played out with Mr. Peanut Butter?
The other thing, to close maybe on this topic, is that in BoJack's stint as this woke male feminist, one of the lines that he's force-fed, or horse-fed if you prefer, is that Filbert, it doesn't glamorize figures like Filbert or like BoJack, if we want to take it down a level in the inception, but it does normalize them. And I'm curious what you have to say about that, because to me, the show has always had faith in the power of stories and in TV as a medium to really get through to people and to impart these messages in what other media can't. So you look at the reactions to episode two this season, with so many people saying they related to Diane and what she was going through, or lots of people coming out and saying that Todd's asexuality and the portrayal of that is the most relatable thing for them that they've seen in TV in years, in decades. Clearly it can touch people in these deep ways, and that can't be entirely positive, right? You have to think that there are people out there who are taking the wrong message away from these shows, and who see a role model, or who are willing to overlook his flaws. And we see this time and time again, whether it's like Walter White in Breaking Bad or House. I mean, personally, like, I went through a phase as a teenager where, like, I saw House as someone to emulate, and it's like, looking back now, that was not the lesson to take away from that. But this is a theme that we see time and time again. So I think that does have some real power to it. On the other hand, I'm not sure what the normalization critique is really getting at. Like, it feels like the kind of thing that you say when you have this general sense of these, but don't have anything to flesh out at all.
Yeah, it was the whole, again, diagramming about normalization. I was a little confused about it, because it did seem sort of like a break from format as well. We're going to, like, illustrations. It seemed a bit, I don't know, atypical. But then I guess I realized that denormalizing normalization, you really need to almost overcompensate, because if the point of normalization is that you're essentially sort of blind to what's going on around you, you're just so used to the circumstances, you really need to be, like, woken up from that dream, realize that things are amiss. So while I will say that I don't think it was handled in the it's handled a bit of a clumsy way, I guess it was appropriate given the nature of, like, well, to your point, Dom, need to be really roused from that slumber to say, like, hey, look, this is what normalization is, and this is what some pieces of pop culture are literally using, you know, Kiefer Sutherland and Jimmy Fallon as examples of people who are you know, examples of normalizing behavior and the effect that can have in the ways that we perceive certain activities outside of pop culture.
And I do think that it's kind of a tricky issue just in the real world too, because I think most people, or I'll speak for myself, some of these movies or shows that normalize bad behavior, you do sort of like them, but at the same time, you hear from other people of, like, do we need another movie about a straight white guy who is behaving badly? And the answer is probably no. At the same time, there's this sense that you can get entertainment out of it. And this idea of normalizing versus what I think is actually more of the issue with movies and TV is glamorizing these flawed, complex, anti-hero males. I don't think anyone would think Breaking Bad is normal, but I do think they would think it would be badass Heisenberg. And I think that's more of the issue. And I think, honestly, that's more of the issue. That's something you can address more. I think normalizing behavior is more like what Jimmy Fallon was doing, where you're trying to make someone in the real world who's doing something bad, make them relatable. I think glamorizing is a problem because people are easily influenced by media, but I think at the same time, you're more likely to be able to watch something like Breaking Bad or a movie like Scarface or a movie like Wolf of Wall Street and be able to tell that, like, yeah, in the moment, there's, like, an exciting energy to it, but when it's over, you know that it was bad. And I think that's the difference. And I think True Detective, which is what they're more or less spoofing or criticizing with Filbert, is it's kind of in the middle, because it really did almost make a lot of, not excuses, but acted like this is inevitable, like the way these people behave is inevitable. And it because it was so I guess raw would be the word, and gritty, doesn't really have that element that a lot of other stories have, where you're looking at an anti-hero and you can really differentiate. What I think makes BoJack, this show, different is that it is very self-referential in that way. And I think it does make a point of saying BoJack, the character, doesn't think people are supposed to like Filbert. But then during the course of the episode 4, he realizes, oh, they kind of do. Maybe we can do something to fix that. And I think that though, recognizing that is probably a good thing, and probably what'll keep it from getting too into the weeds there.
with that, we can dive into the real set piece of this season. And this season, I think the structure is very impressive. So they're into an even more experimental level, and almost a full half of the season, it has these this unconventional format to it. So with the Dog Days Are Over, you have Diane's trip to Vietnam Express, the listicle format. You have Free Churro, which we're about to dive into. You have Int Sub, where you have the two therapists relating the story through this conversation at the restaurant. You have the Halloween episode, where you have four different timelines and we're flipping back and forth between all of them. And then finally, you have the Filbert episode within a BoJack episode, where BoJack ends up strangling Gina at the end. And with that in mind, is there a tipping point where you think that becomes overwhelming, where these normal episodes don't really have room to breathe anymore, or can they all coexist harmoniously?
I was perfectly okay with it. I don't need a linear structure or like an episodic structure to enjoy the show personally. So maybe that's a question of taste, but for me, it worked perfectly fine.
The only thing for me that I had I wouldn't say a problem with, but like, I think we are now waiting for the other shoe to drop in episode 11. And I'll say, I think in the pantheon of episode 11, this one, a bit paltry in comparison, not to mitigate the horrific thing that BoJack did to Gina on the set. But like, compared to Sarah Lynn dying or BoJack on the boat or watching BoJack's mother try to piece her broken memories back together, this one just sort of, I don't know, it felt like a bit of a step back. So I'm hoping that the writers and the viewers subsequently don't need to think like, oh, this is episode 11, something big is going to happen. Cause it's like one of those things where just like, if you set yourself up for expectations, you pretty much always have the hope of being disappointed, right?
I liked it more than you did, I think, but that is a very tough pantheon to crack into when you look at the other candidates in there, like Time's Arrow and so on. And it is definitely within their range to next season, knowing that everybody's expecting kind of dark tragedy in episode 11, to have that be the lightest and funniest episode of the season, but for no one to be able to appreciate that because they're expecting some terrible turnover to happen at the end. So let's actually dive into Free Churro now then. Mike, I'll give the floor to you. I'm sure you have a better way of articulating just why this episode was so impressive here than I do.
I mean, you have to talk about the style of it. It's in a show that I wouldn't say has ADD, but a lot of like quick cuts around scenes. This is one nearly unbroken 26-minute, essentially monologue by Will Arnett. And it's so much fun because it's one of those things, I don't know when the tipping point was for you guys. For me, it was maybe like the 5 or 6 minute mark when I realized, oh, okay, this is what they're doing. And it was just such a nice change of pace. When BoJack is a character that intrinsically functions in, you know, dragging people around him down to his gritty level, when it's Jim Bear in front of a podium talking about admittedly someone who is might have dragged him down, is dead. But like you said before, Sadie, it's essentially his way to sort of vent his feelings. It's such a different take on it, and I'm actually surprised I didn't do it before. This is probably my like most memory or moment of this season, just because not to get too personal, but like my mother's family is pretty fucked up, for a manner of speaking, and that was due in part due to the actions of the matriarch of the family, who had like 3 marriages, was barely in the house, like let her kids run wild. It was a crazy household to grow up in. She finally passed away about 3 years ago. There was so much fraught history between everyone in the room. And I remember us being there. We sat in like the lounge beforehand and the synagogue before we actually went to the ceremony itself. And we were joking around. We were laughing our asses off. We were wise asses. We went in for the funeral and we were just all bawling, getting up, you know, telling these stories and all just sort of like coming together. And then as soon as it ended, we were right back to where we were. And it was just this weird sort of cocktail of feelings that really made me click in this episode. What do you do when you are mourning somebody who you have this fraught relationship with, who you don't necessarily have the best memories of? And there are just so many good quotes from this episode. But the one that really like got me choked up was, you know, when he finally lashes out. It's the time when I think BoJack breaks as well, when he yells at Beatrice's corpse and he says, "I'm your son. All I had was you." And it comes on the, you know, the tail end of his ICU, unfortunately, heartbreaking epiphany. But that's why it ruminated with me so well and why I love it so much, is because it really did sort of bring up, again, the universality that comes with some of these things and the difficulty that can come in really summing up your feelings towards a complication in the course of just one speech.
Yeah, this episode, as BoJack would say, was one long kick in the urethra. And if there was a part of this which doesn't hit you on some level, then I and lots of other people there would be envious of you, because I think this is one of those episodes which they don't want to find themselves relating to what BoJack is saying, but they definitely can.
I think the line that resonated with me the most, thinking about it personally from a, not to like say anything specific, but like from a personal perspective, is the line he sort of repeats it two different ways, which is her reflecting on her husband and him reflecting on his mother, that my mother is dead now and everything is worse. And I just, that line really, the first time I watched the episode, it really does like hit you right in the face, because that is such a feeling that, honestly, the way it was coming across in the show was like, but that's not true. Like, nothing, did anything really change from when his mother died? He feels like he doesn't have any great stories to share or any fond memories. And she, Beatrice, felt the same about Butterscotch as far as that. And then this idea that, but maybe deep down, you just feel it. You know that even though you can't really reconcile like this, that there was something good, maybe you really can't find it. Maybe you just know on like a deep down level that everything is worse and you can't explain why. Maybe you don't even miss this person. Maybe they were bad in your life, but you just know that everything's worse. And something about that was very, like, it really did speak to me.
Well, I don't want to project too much, but like, you'd have to imagine that this was, you know, his final parent. Both of his parents are dead now. And you have to imagine that there's something interesting, and it makes you sort of look at your life and realize, like, oh, I have Hollyhock, and that's basically it. So maybe that's what he means by that, is, like, it made him sort of realize how alone he was. And unlike Diane, he is not reveling in his solitude. He's instead saying, like, wow, I have been drowning for this whole time, and now I'm the only person drowning. There is this odd community that exists. He has this fantastic quote: all three of us were drowning and we didn't know how to save each other, but there was an understanding that we were all drowning together. Those two people have gone under. He's still there clinging to the surface. How does he feel now?
I feel bad for Hollyhock, who potentially has to give 8 of these eulogies over the course of her life. But yeah, I think that aspect of it does resonate with a lot of people. And it's what he said about being jealous of orphans because they can imagine their parents to be that they want them to be. In a way, it's almost a weird contrast to the usual depressive mindset where you assume the worst about things and you have this pessimistic view. And you can imagine someone saying, like, if I didn't have parental figures around, I imagine that they would hate me too. But maybe the response to that is, well, I have parents, and I do in fact imagine that they are disappointed in me or don't love me or whatever, and that's the way that manifests itself instead.
I do think it was also interesting that he had this idea of maybe the reason why everything's worse now is because nothing can get better. Like, this relationship that was so complicated, there's no longer any instance that could exist where we improve our standing with each other and where we make amends or we forgive each other or we find some sort of common ground. I guess that's what the part is that could make it everything is worse now, is that when people in your life are gone for good, they're really, all of that potential goes away with them. And I think that's probably hard to reconcile.
Yeah, that's the Becker thing, right? That's what he says, that like he watched every episode, I did as well, and fruitlessly hoping that the show had all the great components, why isn't it good? And then at a certain point you realize, like, it's not going to get good. And that's a hard thing to reconcile. Personally feels like he's the one who landed unlucky on the roulette wheel in this moment. He feels like he got screwed. He had all the makings of a good life, and for one reason or another, it just didn't. It's a really sort of interesting comparison and revelation that he has. And the ICU thing, well, I didn't catch it initially, so I'm glad that, you know, I sort of caught it at the same time he did. But man, that is heartbreaking for him to discover in the moment, because he took so much pride in that. he felt like all he wanted to do was to get seen and acknowledged by his parents, who seemed so self-absorbed that they any regard they gave for him was disregard, only for him to realize that, like, her final words to him weren't even at him. They were in the room that they were in. Is just it's crushing. And I could imagine why BoJack is sort of a broken person if he sort of associates memories and relationships to things like that and the lack of closure.
And that's the one memory that he was clinging onto after over 50 years of being his mother, right? That's in all of that time, that's the one thing that stood out as maybe there's a hope of something deeper there, of some actual real connection. And to touch on what you said about the format, Mike, that a show that has so much going on in any episode that you can't catch it all on one viewing, and which in the past has done the exact opposite of this in having an episode with zero dialogue, the fact that they're able to do the exact converse of that and pull it off so effectively, it's a fairly bold statement about their own creative range and their own creative ambitions, but it's I think it's a justified one. They pulled it off perfectly, and I've seen some mixed reviews of this episode, but I think that's from people who it doesn't connect with level, and so for them it's just some guy talking for 25 minutes and who wants to watch that. But for the people on the other side, for the people who this did really hit on some level, then this is maybe not the best episode in the entire BoJack canon, but certainly one that will stick with them the most of this and of really any TV show.
Yeah, this will definitely be up there for one of my favorites, just because, I don't know, I love, because I don't know if I even call it innovative, I guess it is, right? Because the way we're used to the television medium is to cut between several scenes, even something like the, you know, panning shots, wide shots, tracking shots, have been able to sort of have things take place over the course of one scene, but like things move. This is essentially stationary and inert, and instead the words are taking us on a journey. And that's what I love. This might be the best written episode of BoJack Horseman, in my opinion, because it has to be. There's literally nothing else. There's no dressing. It's all about the words.
The only part that sort of, and honestly, like, I'm starting to tote my own memory, because, like, the camera's on him for, like, the whole thing, except for the, they show him in the car with Butterscotch at the beginning, right?
Mm-hmm.
See, I definitely back that out. I thought I remember that anyways. That stuck out to me, because that scene, like, that conversation, just the whole demeanor of his father, and just the thing. There's something so oppressive about that sort of negative energy that it really, for me, like, was one of the earlier sort of stories he brought up, and that really set the tone for the rest of the episode, because it was just so it felt so heavy, even though, like, there was kind of a punchline at the end where he's like, welcome, because he, like, there was a moment of levity, but everything leading up to it, just the idea of someone just going on and on about every little thing and just unhappy with every aspect of their life and taking it out on the kid and blaming the wife for minute little things. There was such a negative energy about it that it really did bring the episode down, and it was already pretty bad because there's a funeral. It really was something that weighed on me, the whole scene, or the whole eulogy giving portion.
Well, it's a nice parallel as well, though, right? Because in both cases, it's one person prattling on, giving their own worldviews, while their audience sits captive, can't necessarily respond the entire time. The person giving the monologue doesn't necessarily understand that they're sort of in the wrong circumstances. I would say BoJack's more so in the wrong circumstances than Butterscotch at this point. But again, if we're going to this idea of BoJack trying to escape his lineage, but realizing he's much more so than he thought, I thought it was weird to sort of have this sort of cold open into a scene that just stays the same for 20 plus minutes. I thought it was a great introduction to sort of give a peek under the casket as a mystery that is Butterscotch Horseman.
The part of the episode that I've heard the most controversy about is the end. So when we cut to this reveal that actually BoJack is in the wrong pilot, and he's been talking to this audience of geckos or lizards or some creature that is definitely not a horse this entire time, and he's just been unaware, or maybe doesn't care, that he's delivering this monologue to an audience that doesn't know him, didn't know his mother, and is probably very confused about what they're hearing right now. I've heard very mixed reviews on that. So some people saying that after the episode has punched them in the gut repeatedly and really brought them to this dark place, that was enough to flip the switch and just get maybe one of the biggest laughs of any BoJack episode out of them, because it was really noting what had come before it. But on the other hand, some people are saying that the end of them in this very reflective mood, and that it was fittingly somber towards the end, and then that was so jarring compared to everything else that it just immediately broke that sense of immersion for them.
I mean, well, first, it's always tough to say because comedy is so subjective as to like whether or not the joke worked. I personally thought it did because I just thought it was so dark. It was like akin to BoJack screwing over Daniel Radcliffe on the, you know, do celebrities know things, let's find out, et cetera, by burning all the money, screw him over. But it's also sort of emblematic of the fact that, you know, BoJack realized that he thought he was talking to an audience. No, he's just talking to himself the entire time. And as someone who spends his entire life performing for one reason or another, he has now realized that this was not necessarily the audience that he wanted. I don't think it had any sort of, you know, sticking moments to him. I just thought in a that had a couple of funny moments. You know, you had him trying to go for these vaudeville jokes. I'll admit there is some humor in him doing that really gross, grody face that Beatrice Horseman made before she died. But I thought for a show that markets itself as a comedy with drama, I thought a nice moment of comedy to add at the end. I wouldn't say it lifted my mood, but I thought it was a nice button personally.
I laughed. I thought it was funny, and it did, like, for me, it cut the tension episode, and I just felt relieved when it happened and, like, the episode was over. I felt good after that because it was funny. It is obviously ridiculous that, like, the premises he didn't realize until he looked in the casket when he's looking out at these geckos the whole time. But I will say that what makes the comedy of, like, him saying it to the wrong audience and that it was meant to be a laugh, I think at the end of the day, maybe the point they were trying to make is that, like, it really doesn't matter who you're saying it to. He was really just saying it for himself and his own peace of mind and his own self-reflection. And it, at the end of the day, it wouldn't have mattered who he was saying it to, as long as he was saying it and having that for himself.
Eulogies are for ourselves. They're not for the audience. They're not for the dead person. And even if it was an empty room, if this was a soliloquy instead of a monologue, it still would have had the same impact for us as an audience. The audience, which is behind the screen that BoJack doesn't know is there, but also on BoJack himself. That was a cathartic thing for him that he needed to say and needed to get out there, no matter who was hearing it, if anybody.
Can you imagine being at your funeral when some guy just comes in, spends half an hour ranting and raving about how much he loved his mom, then he hates his mom, then he loved his mom? Like, I mean, it'd be an experience, certainly, but I don't know if... actually, knowing my depraved sense of humor, I probably would be laughing to just alleviate whatever dour mood I'd be in.
You would wonder who, like, which twisted member of your family had set this up as some weird kind of bit.
It would have happened. It absolutely... Or would have, like, a weird friend of one of my members, or, like, one of my family members, many, like, slurs that just comes in and goes and has different careers. So it would not be, you know, out of the realm of possibility.
I do have a lot of anxiety around showing up to, like, the wrong place and, like, not expecting to recognize anyone right away. And so I'm just sort of there mingling with people I don't know. And then I realize too late that I'm not where I'm supposed to be. And not only am I, like, with a bunch of people who I would have no reason to be there, but I'm also late to wherever I'm supposed to be going. So I wouldn't like that.
I don't want to be, like, asking for directions at a funeral, right? Like, I want to have the sense of self-assuredness to navigate that situation properly. And I can definitely imagine a situation like that happening, for sure.
You don't want to nudge the person and be like, is this the funeral for so-and-so? Because that feels inappropriate.
Like, yeah, who do you know that died? I hope it's the same person. We can bond over that.
Funeral home shouldn't be treated like the first day of semester school, right? Where you're like, oh, I don't think this is the right room for basic economics.
Yeah, there's definitely sitcom material in there, of the type that BoJack himself would probably get cast for somehow. But do either of you have anything else to touch on about this episode, or really any aspect of Hall that we haven't touched on yet?
Yeah, we haven't touched upon 3 hours. I guess the length of half the season of BoJack, it seems appropriate.
Stop length shaming the podcast, Mike. You yourself into. You know what you signed up for.
Exactly, absolutely. And I love it. I love it all. I mean, yeah, the fact that we spent 3 hours talking about this just shows how, even though I will say this season wasn't my favorite, it still demonstrates a depth and innovation and specifically a character study that surpasses even some of the best TV out there today and is a show that, you know, growing up, I never wanted to watch shows that made me sad or angry. I always wanted to watch shows that would make me happy. I guess I was sort of like BoJack in that regard, and that I sought out the cheesy TGIF sitcoms to sort of maybe tie me over whenever I was feeling upset. And maybe it's me overcompensating to this day, but I glom onto shows like this. We can go from Todd slip sliding around in, you know, 100-year-old family heirloom lube to BoJack eviscerating his mother in a 25-minute monologue. This show is a tour de force. Even in what might not be its strongest season, it still has so many statements about morality, about psychology, about celebrity culture that just speak volumes. Literally, we have spoken volumes about it. So I'm happy that another one is in the can. I can't wait to see it come back for another year, because I can only imagine what's happening. I'm super excited for Raphael Bob Waksberg as well, because it seems like he has sort of built this into, you know, some other spin-offs. I won't say spin-offs, but like Tuca and Birdie, which is a new Netflix show starring Tiffany Haddish in a very similar animalistic style, is coming out soon. Amazon's Undone. It's going to be the platform's first half-hour adult animated comedy. So I'm very happy in this day and age that I feel like this is a new type of direction that adult animation is going in, and people, including us three, are really on board with it. And I'm excited to see where it goes from here, from both a BoJack perspective and just telling all these different stories from various creators using this medium.
I feel similarly. I feel really just happy to have the show. It's like independent film, and I like this sort of style of animation and storytelling and the way it's released and everything. It really is, for me, a show that I like to laugh, and I have a specific sense of humor, and I laugh a lot at the show. There were a lot of funny moments that I think there's enough diversity and types of humor that everyone can get something out of it. I loved John Leguizamo's performance, his voice performance as Yolanda. I just thought every single word he said, even though it was like, it was kind of crass and you could call it potty humor, there was something so earnest and fatherly about what he was saying, and I just loved it. And at the same time, there's these jokes in the episode where they go to the premiere of his show, and there's Ziggy Abler and Abel Ziegler, and their popsicle stick punchline, setup punchline humor. I laughed at almost every one of those jokes, and it just felt great. And like, have these lighthearted laughs. And then at the same time, like Mike said, I really do get something out of the show emotionally. I find it really has something to say. And every now and then a line will come up and I'll just think how strongly I relate to that, or how evocative it is of just the light, like your experience of life and these things that I think sometimes other shows have trouble addressing, because you can't always just put it out there the way they found a way to, in just these kind of flawed characters who are able to really call each other out and reference their own stuff and just put it all out there and either address it again when it comes up, or maybe just leave it if it's something that can be handled in one sweep and that's enough of it. At least you've had that moment, had that something special that relates to maybe just an individual person watching it, and then you're back in it for the jokes or back in it for the next maybe storyline that doesn't speak to you personally. But even the ones that aren't obviously relating to me in any way, I do feel connected to them. And I've loved, I don't want to overpraise any show, but, and I'm terrible, I have no ability to rank anything, but I don't have a favorite season or least favorite season or favorite episode or favorite or least favorite episode. I just view it all as one for some reason, and it just really is satisfying to me.
We need a listicle, Sadie. We need your top 10 something or other.
Honestly, I can't list anything. If I like something, I just say I really like it, and then if I dislike something, I say I really like it. And I had a bad habit in university of just saying, like, if I loved a movie, I would be like, this is the best movie ever. And I said it for every movie I saw for like a month straight. And people are like, so what movies do you actually think are the best? I'm like, I don't know. I liked all of these equal. It's hard for me. I can't rank. And which is funny, because ranking is trendy. People love a list, and I can't list anything.
You will never get hired by Girl Crush with that attitude.
I know.
For me,
yeah, Dom, you're actually in line for a job considering all your hit top five lists that are making the rounds in terms of podcasts.
I can't take ownership of those, unfortunately. But
top five doctors or lawyers or whatever is a good list.
If they need a new contributor, I know who to send to. But for me, it worries me how much I like this show and how much it resonates on some level. And I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, and if me watching the show is even healthy, but I'm very happy that it has some place in my life currently. And I said in our recap, first four seasons, coming out of season four, I thought this is my favorite show, I'm pretty sure. And season five has cemented that. I know some people say it's a step down or a departure from the other seasons in some way. For me, it's very much about the same things that BoJack quintessentially is about. And I think it is my favorite season, or will go down. And I'm very excited to see what season six brings. I'm confident we will get that. And I have faith in them to deliver a tour de force once again. But as BoJack said in his monologue, you never get a happy ending because there's always more show until there isn't. And I think we've reached that point. So I'm very thankful to both of you for joining me. As we know, the whole point of television is it's a collaborative medium where one person gets all the credit. Luckily, with podcasting, we can spread that credit around a bit. So I'm very grateful to you both once again. Where can people find you if they want to express their gratitude or to get in touch over something else?
I like how you said it's the one that one person won't take credit for when we're talking on the Dom and Colin podcast. I think one name takes preference.
Keeping that title, Mike. I don't know what you're talking about.
But neither one of us are them.
I don't want Colin getting any credit for this.
Same. I can co-sign that. But Mike, you have taken credit for many, many other podcasts and creative works in your time. Where can people find those and you if they're so inclined?
So you can find me shilling random things I do out on the internet on my Twitter at @MikeBloomType. I'm doing weekly coverage of Survivor in my own silly Todd-esque way on the RHAP B&B. Actually, the RHAP B&B sounds like a business that Todd would legitimately invest in. Johnson's like accounting character would be so fed up about that. But Liana Boris and I are talking Survivor every week. I'm doing occasional other reality TV coverage here and there, especially when Top Chef gets back in season later on this year. I've been doing a lot of writing for Parade.com and especially The Hollywood Reporter over the past few months, including a nice article I was able to do last month in honor of BoJack premiering. I got to speak with Raphael Bob Waksberg. I got to speak with Adam Reed from Ardor, and I got to speak with Lauren Bouchard from Bob's Burgers. How, again, as I spoke about at the end of my final words, there's been an interesting sort of shift in adult animation, in my opinion, where not only has it become a bit more emotionally, dramatically focused, but it's, in my opinion, gained even more legitimate art form than even back in the halcyon days of The Simpsons and South Park. So I got to you know, hear their thoughts a bit on that. I've done coverage of Star Trek, of Comic-Con, of The Haunting of Hill House, which is another new Netflix show. So be sure to check all that out and hopefully some more fun stuff to come.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. It's just Sadie_11. I just want to say thank you so much for having me. I have a regular kind of day job. So I don't really podcast much. I listen to a lot of podcasts on my way to and from work. But so there's nothing, you're not going to find anything exciting on my Twitter. But I do appreciate being asked to come on. I've loved all the seasons, and it was really fun to talk about it.
You can find either of us, or Mike, or Sadie on Twitter. Thanks to all of you once again, and we'll talk to all of you again soon. Take care, everybody.